Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 75 of Dominario's Judgment, a weekly Constructed Magic podcast brought to you by me, Dom Harvey, along with Ari Lax. And this week we are covering the full spoiler for a set which I think is going to take us through most of Constructed Magic. It's going to make definitely a big impact in Pioneer, probably a decent size impact in Modern, and then maybe a little bit further afield as well.
Yeah, this is one of those weird sets, sort of like, I mean, I guess it is a very clear comparison between the Brothers War and Strixhaven in the featuring of the showcase slot in the packs, whatever they're called, this time around. But if you actually look at the contents of the set beyond that, it's a lot of the same style of thing where it's like, there's a lot of weird synergy pieces that may or may not have a home, that aren't like necessarily broken, but some of them could, in theory, go off with some stuff. I'm thinking, like, it's a lot of, like, clever Lumamancer cards. I don't know if I see an expressive iteration from this set, but we'll get around to talking from that.
To be fair, I did not see an expressive iteration in the set that had expressive iteration, so that's my bad. I'm trying to be better here in the future. But yeah, we made this long list of cards that we thought were worth talking about in some capacity, and then when I went through and tried to split them up between these are the cards that may be worth looking Pioneer, these are the Modern playables, and this is maybe where some crossover, it felt like a good 80-85% of the list was just for Pioneer, and then the Modern playables were, there were some here and there, and some which I think are safe bets to talk about, but for the most part, I think this is in the mold of some of the last few sets we've had, where there are one or two all-stars in the set, and then the actual roster beyond that is pretty shallow, but that's okay, because the set has made an impact with those few specific cards.
Yeah, it will, at least in Pioneer, I think those few specific cards are going to have a big impact. I think it sort of remains to be seen in Modern. I'm a little further down on it, maybe, than you are from that point of view, but I guess there's at least... Okay, there's one card. There is one card that is very obvious and worth discussing.
Yes, and we will get to that in due course. First, though, we're going to get through some brief housekeeping and then the challenges from the weekend. So, as always, you can find the podcast on Patreon at patreon.com/dominarios_judgment. Many thanks to Tom, our newest patron, who did just that. You can find the podcast on Twitter at twitter.com/dominario_pod. Until we all give up and move to whatever improvement on Mastodon is hopefully coming down the pipeline. And then you can find us on Discord as well. And the links to all of that are in the show notes there. So with that being said, let's get into the Modern challenges from this past weekend, where if you are one of these people who replies to every Modern challenge thread with, wow, fuck Tron, well, there are two Tron decks in this finals for you to fuck.
Yeah, well, there's three across both the top eights, too, if you count the Prison Tron. I don't quite know what the Tron Resurgence is about. It doesn't make a ton of sense if you view it in the context of, like, there is less four color than there used to be. But also, Tron is good enough that maybe you... I don't want to say you don't need a reason. Maybe the reason for all this Tron is actually the drop-off in both Rakdos and Izzet. Not just because, like, the Blood Moon aspects of those decks, but there's a lot of other problems that those decks cause for Tron along the way, like Counterspell, you know, scamming out of grief, like all sorts of things that Tron's four card hands are not the best against.
With that in mind, though, it's like, what are the decks that Tron preys on that those decks receding is going to give rise to instead? Because you might think, okay, well, if there's less Murktide, less Rakdos Scam or normal Rakdos, what have you, then combo decks, linear decks are going to be able to rise up and feast on the format. Tron doesn't want to get paired against those. You don't want to get calibrated blasted if you're playing Tron. And so, all right, well, it's not that side of the format. Is it these random creature decks which are also kind of popping up? Maybe, but if the go-to prey for Tron in the past in the form of these control decks and these mid-range decks just don't have what it takes to keep up, if those are either not present as much, or not even that bad against Tron anymore, then I'm not quite sure what the incentive to play this deck actually is.
Well, I think if you look at this top eight, like, this very what-should-you-be-playing view of the format is not what's happening here. So decks that have, you know, been featured in these top eights, we have a Jund sacrifice list, similar to the one that I believe, was Piper the one who top-eighted a Magic Online qualifier with that deck earlier this year? This is the Ravenous Squirrel Cat Oven Raghavan deck that top aided. Merfolk top aided, as it always seems to be doing these days.
I don't know. I think that We highlighted the Prison Tron deck as a deck that had some more recent results, and those made some amount of sense, even if I think you were a bit lower on the deck than I was, just in terms of structurally, how good is it at doing its thing? And then we highlighted some potential improvements in the form of stuff like Inscribed Tablet or maybe some cards from Brothers World, which you would think would shore it up in that regard. And yet this is almost classic Prison Tron, if you can say that about a deck that has existed for like 6 months at this point.
Yeah, I mean, it has just not changed. I think that Chalice is, again, the Rakdos and Izzet decks, despite being vulnerable to Chalice, are like vulnerable to it in a kind of dicey way, whereas the decks that are vulnerable to Chalice now are like hard vulnerable to it. So if that makes sense, I kind of like it a little more. Like, for example, Chalice on one is going to absolutely destroy this Sacrifice deck. You are basically left like trying to beat Tron with Grist. Not great.
Yeah, I guess Chalice is also your one hope against the bigger and badder Tron deck that it lost to in the finals here, where it almost feels like one of those 2017-2018 kind of matchups where you would be playing some kind of a Mox Opal Prison deck or whatever against Tron, and that was basically the worst possible pairing you could imagine. And you really needed some weird corner case thing to happen for you to have a chance there. And maybe this is the same way, where, yeah, sometimes you'll get to Chalice on one and lock them out of a draw that's overly reliant on Chromatic Stars and Ancient Stirrings and so on. But for the most part, the matchup is purely a race to who can assemble Tron and get the first Khan the Great Creator into play. And they are better at assembling Tron and have more Khans and can find their Khans more easily with Ancient Stirrings. And so, however you slice it, that's not a good matchup.
Yeah, that's totally fair. I think that looping back around, it's hard to predict that, like, oh, I'm going to play Prison Tron now. All these jokers better not show up with real Tron. Like, I don't really know how you're supposed to predict that.
I think you're not. You just kind of grit your teeth and nod when it happens to you. Let's get into some of the more adventurous decks from this pair of top eights, because we have maybe the most predictable winner of all time for the other challenge in Happy Sandwich on Hammer, but there are also some interesting fringe decks are showing up here. So a copy of Merfolk, you love to see it potentially, but the one I really want to focus on is the Crushrobot BG deck, who in the past you would think, okay, Crushrobot, another top eight with Hammer, that's no surprise either, but this is Hammer adjacent, but we're going into a whole different color here.
This is, I don't know, it looks like Crushrobot is trying to contest the slot of Monocolor King, though I guess from the Urza Saga side of things. This is Mono Red, I guess we can call it Affinity, because we called Affinity for so many years without Affinity cards. If it has Kringle Plating, it's Affinity, right? And there's four of those here?
Something like that, I believe, yes.
Very bizarre. It's just, you know, 8 Blast, Galv, Shrap, and then Lightning Bolt as well, backing up, like, Raghavan wearing Cranial Plating, Experimental Synthesizer with no real ways to sacrifice it besides paying the cost. And then like Urza Saga and Mishra's Factory in the lands. I don't really know what to make of this deck.
Yeah, you can sacrifice it to Shrapnel Blast, I suppose, but it is funny to see Cranial Plating in a deck that is completely lacking in evasive creatures. So instead of putting this on your Signal Pass or your Vault Scourge or something, this is, I'm going to make my Memnite into a 6-1 Memnite, and that's going to be a lot harder to block than it was 10 seconds ago. I guess Cranial Plating on Raghavan is kind of funny in that context too. And yeah, this mana base is something to behold. So we have 4 Urza Saga, no surprise there, 4 Mishra's Factory, so one of the first appearances of that timeless card since it was reprinted in MH2. And then the actual red sources are even more impressive. So we have our 7 Snow-Covered Mountains, and then we have 2 Ramunap Ruins, a Den of the Bugbear, a Shinka the Bloodsoaked Keep, and 2 Sokensan Crucible of Defiance. So if you are a red utility land and you exist in Modern, you probably found your way into this deck somehow.
Well, this is one of the best Shinkas I've seen. I know there was a long time where it was just showing up in decks for Raghavan, but we're actually giving Argigantha first strike in this deck.
I forgot about that angle, but yeah, that's a thing you can do.
Yeah, the thing that really gets me here are the 4 Void Mirrors in the sideboard of your deck with, like, 1 drop artifacts, 8 colorless lands, and also Memnite.
There is that. There is some anti-synergy going on there. I'm not quite sure why those couldn't just be Chalice of the Void if the main use for that is against other Cascade decks, but maybe you're trying to lock out some amount of pitch elementals or something like that as well?
Well, Tron did. This was the day after Tron won the challenge, so maybe it was just an immediate reaction of switching those out.
Yeah, I remember when Void Mirror was previewed, we came in here and we were very skeptical of its ability to actually lock out Tron, bearing in mind that they have these chromatic stars and chromatic spheres they can sneak underneath it. They have actual green sources or can tutor up green sources if it comes to that. And so we were not optimistic about that card's role in that matchup. Turns out that never really mattered all that much because Tron kind of vanished and no one was playing Void Mirror anyway. But this is the one time, finally, where that may come up.
I guess to kind of wrap around to that, I think there's a couple things going on here that make this a reasonable Void Mirror deck, aside from the stuff that we pointed out. One is that it significantly slows down Tron. So, like, one, it's not going to hard lock them out, but if your deck is, like, a bunch of Galvanize and Shrapnel Blast, that doesn't matter. And also, like, it is almost incidental. Like, we said, oh, well, we're going to play Void Mirror to beat Cascade, and it's really just, like, I may as well make it Tron hate if I care about that at that point. That's kind of like the layers going on there with that and why Void Mirror might actually make sense right now. Mm-hmm. Though the Alpine Moons, I'm a little more skeptical of those.
Yes. We do also have a copy of 60 card Elementals with Gahira. So this is basically the 80 card Yorion Elementals deck that was the offshoot of 4-color that was in vogue a few months ago, slimmed down to 60 cards. So we still have Oath of Nissa as our kind of a one-drop cantrip that ties the room together. We have 4 Ren and 6, 4 Teferi, Prismatic Ending, Lightning Bolt as our cheap removal, 4 Solitude, 4 Fury, 4 Omnath, 4 Risen Reef, 2 Eladamri's Call, just sneaking a few toolbox elements in there, and then 1 Endurance and 1 Titania as your kind of big hitter there.
Yeah, I like Titania a lot. I don't know what to think about this exact list in terms of, like, whether I care about elementals right now, because these top eights are kind of a mess to even figure out what you care about, but I will just add a vote in the Titania column. It's just really good at ensuring that this deck mops up things like Rakdos Scam, where, like, technically you should be ahead if you're allowed to cast your spells, but maybe you're behind because they've done things that have power and toughness, and, like, none of that matters once you just cast Titania and make some 5/3s.
Notably, the only presence of Ephemerate here is 2 copies in the sideboard, and I like that choice a lot because when I was trying to reconstruct a 60-card Elementals deck for myself, I found that incorporating all of the Elementals you want and the Ephemerates to pair with them, and then also these interactive pieces or these glue cards, it was just difficult to fit all of that within a 60-card shell. And Ephemerate was always the most hit or miss element of that, where there were some matchups where that paired with some kind of incarnation was a fantastic strategy, other times where it seemed almost impossible to line that up properly in the face of removal. And so having that as a sideboard tactic you can turn to as applicable, I think makes a lot of sense, but you're not leaning on it hard in the main deck.
Yeah, I mean, I would also point to, I think that some of the value of Ephemerate was often in your, like, extended toolbox targets. Like, Ephemerate targeting, I mean, I guess Eternal Witness wasn't stock, but, like, that type of card where it's like, oh, there's going to be one of this in my 80-card deck so that my Ephemerates that usually are just targeting Solitude could also target this as an alternate endgame. And then once you trim down to 60, you're, like, not going to have an Eternal Witness in your deck. And then it's just like, well, Ephemerate is just extending my Solitudes and Furies, at which point it should just be for the matchups where you really need the second and third trigger of those. So, like, you're going to Ephemerate the shit out of Yawgmoth, but that's about it.
And then we have a copy of Goblins in the hands of Play to Win, who won the first challenge after Dominaria United, beating me in the finals, still not bitter. And then a copy of Urza in the top eight. This is the kind of fair blue-white Urza deck with a bunch of Esper Sentinels and Thought Monitors and so on. Still very confused by this deck, but just another data point in its favor, I suppose. And then the deck that you alluded to, which I think is worth circling back to, is Punt Then Whine here with Jund Sacrifice. So this is quite similar to that Hogpog deck from a few months ago. This is, you know, we have Cat Oven, we have Ravenous Squirrel and Ragavan as these two very high-powered one-drops in the shell. And then this interesting spread of 3-drops. We have our Mayhem Devils, but then we also have 3 Gris and 2 Obnixilus the Adversary as well.
Yeah, that is a card that has... I don't know. It has had very mixed results. I've really enjoyed it in decks like these where you are actually chip-shotting your way to lethal and, like, the double plus on a given turn is really powerful, but at the same time, it is expensive and not like directly high impact. So I don't know if this deck, there's 9 3 drops in this deck that feels like slightly on the high end, especially with Urza Saga, but I think I've yet to cast Obnixilus in this deck, so I don't really want to pass judgment. I will say in the Pioneer equivalent of this deck, which is like basically the same cards, I liked the first or second copy of it, so it's, yeah, I don't know. I'd have to play with it.
This is also a Kroxa Urza Saga deck competing for demands on your mana, but in the mana base in general, there's some interesting stuff. So like the Castle Lockthrain, I think, is a little ambitious, and I don't know exactly what the right land count should be, but overall, I like this idea, even if I'm not yet convinced that it actually, you know, has what it takes. With that, anything else to get to from this set of results before we dive into our previews here?
I continue to respect the Hippocat, another top 16 from that deck. The Karuga 4-color deck does not show any sign of stopping, and yes, its dominance of the format will continue.
Only a top 16, below par for them at this point, but hopefully they can be back on form before too long. I guess we could briefly touch on the new round of discourse sparked by Aaron Forsyth, of all people, asking the Twitter glitterati for their opinion on why Standard in paper has failed to gain much of a following and what could be done to bring it back. I know this is a topic that we've touched on in passing a few times, and we've mentioned that you know, if Standard is not part of the organized player offering, that probably tells you something pretty large and pretty important about just the incentives going on there. But now that this is officially the main topic of the hour, what do you have to say on it?
I think the thing I want to add that I finally put into words today formally is that one of the big issues in Standard right now, as, like, having switched from the block structure, is that there's like this, there's just no continuance in Standard or like what's going on at all. It's just like every set is a dump of new cards that is unrelated to the previous dump of new cards. So the format effectively rotates every new set because it's just like, I don't know, make your new set power rankings of the best cards in the format, and they're usually all Asika's Chariots and Goldspan Dragons. There's no building anywhere. Like, okay, so since the end of the block structure, which was Eldraine, can you name what decks were based around a, like, actual mechanic that was, like, somewhat linear in any way? Because I came up with 4.
Yeah, I guess you could actually use Eldraine as the poster child of, like, the Rogue deck was pretty good, and then adventures and food and so on. But how much of that is this new model doing its job, and how much of it is Eldraine just being absolutely ridiculous? I don't know.
Yeah, well, so I had two of those that were just like, Eldraine was off the charts and absolutely unreasonable and not how you should do it. And that was food and adventures. The Rogues deck was like sort of a good instantiation of this, where it was like, oh, this theme and Eldraine's theme overlap. And then they just like dropped the ball and released a D&D set that was supposed to be like rogue based and did nothing with it. And like, what the hell was that? But anyways, AFR is its own problem. We're not going to talk about that. The other two I came up with were the Jeskai Mutate deck, which was like a thing, and that was kind of cool. And then Naya Runes. Like, Naya Runes was the one time I think they actually succeeded at this over the last like 3 years.
Yeah, that deck was a really interesting blend of Kamigawa block theme stuff and then Kaldheim block theme stuff. And I say block just out of habit, but as you say, it really is just self-contained stuff from one set at that point. And so, yeah, I think there is less of a kind of a mechanical tie-in between sets, the way that blocks force you to have, and maybe less of a mechanical bleed between different sets or blocks that we saw in the past. I think that a lot of this is just Standard ever really being sustainable, requiring both this perfect storm of factors going into it and also explicit support from top down. It had to be a thing in organized play that you were encouraged to do and not just allowed. So even when Standard was the PPTQ format for a season, let's say, I don't know how many people were always enthusiastic about that necessarily. I think a lot of them would rather have just been playing Modern or something instead, but that was a thing that you understood that you had to do to participate in that process. Or back when you had these tournaments like, you know, States or old style regionals or something, where it was, okay, there is a time on the calendar that I know about 6 months in advance, where I will have to play standard and I have an interest in following, let's say, the coverage of the standard GP that's going on this weekend, so I can stay abreast of any developments in what's going on there. And that level of continuity, I suppose, just doesn't exist anymore, because, you know, you can tune in to watch Worlds and where they're going to be playing standard, but am I going to have a reason to play this format or these decks again? And the format's about to effectively rotate in a few weeks anyway. It's just, I'm not sure what I would say if someone asked me why I should care about standard. And if I can't answer that as someone who, you know, has an interest in growing the game in that sense and who will be watching those tournaments whenever they occur, like, well, I don't know what anyone else is meant to say either.
Yeah, it's just so weird compared to, like, my memories of 15 years ago when Standard was put onto the Pro Tour out of popular demand, and everyone's response after the fact was like, why the hell did you not do this sooner? And, like, I don't think the world has changed. I just think the way that they've approached the game and created what would be Standard has changed, and it doesn't have the same sort of, like, people can get in with a deck and then that deck sticks and they add to it and build to it and build around it. And then they're just like playing their standard deck for 6 months, where like the example I'm thinking is like, even if the format drastically changes, it's still like, oh, well, I was playing a Dark Confidant Umezawa's Jite deck, and like, I'll just play the next one of those, even though it's black white instead of like blue black. And I just get to add, you know, I bought all these new cards from Guild Pact. Don't worry about it. This is the time frame when they put Standard on the Pro Tour. That's why I'm talking about this.
Well, it is weird to think about. There was this time in the early 2000s where Standard was the forgotten format at the Pro Tour level of play, where it might show up at Worlds as one of the three formats for the year. But outside of that, the main Pro Tours that you were trying to get eyeballs on, even though there weren't literal eyeballs because video coverage didn't exist back then, you would play like Extended, Limited, and Block Constructed. Those would be your three Pro Tour formats for the year, and Standard was just on the outside looking in, I guess, and you would play Regionals and then you would play Nationals, but in terms of official support at the highest level of play, there was really nothing to speak of. And yeah, like you said, once they changed that and the floodgates kind of opened there, it was like, yeah, we really should have just been doing this the whole time, shouldn't we?
Yeah, I don't know. Just make a product that people want to play and participate in, and they'll do that. And it's very clear they haven't done that in Standard for many years. But I think at this point, it's approaching, like, how do I fill out, like, you know, what's your billing process? What are my rates for consulting on this? I don't know. It's
to be fair as well, I think that in that thread, which I think was at like 1,200 replies the last I checked and counting, obviously you're going to have a lot of different perspectives and theories and so on. I think a lot of them just factually misstate when the shift started happening. So obviously COVID was catastrophic for any attempt to sustain your paper play of any kind or interest in Standard in that sense. But I feel like this shift really long predated COVID, and it's almost a blessing in a sense that we didn't have a thriving Standard scene going into late 2019, where all of a sudden here's Throne of Eldraine, and then Uro, and then oh shit, here's COVID, and then Companions, and you know, so on and so forth, and just a year straight of just abysmal Standard formats officially killing off interest in the format. I think it actually had been dying a slow death since long before then. And when you look at, for example, the SCG Tour schedule, going back like 2017, 2018, 2019, there was a long stretch in there where they just removed Standard because people weren't showing up to play and people weren't showing up to watch. And they changed that back a little bit for 2019. We had a Standard open here and there with the new sets, and I think those were mostly received okay. But outside of that, I think there was something, and it's hard to locate exactly when, but there was a shift, I want to say 2016, 2017 era, where it felt like that really changed in a fundamental way, and I don't know if it was ever salvageable past that point.
Well, if you want the actual history, the two shocks were, one was BFZ, where the decks cost $1,000 because they were just like fetch dual piles of Jaces and everything, and every deck had the same cards. People weren't the happiest about that, but they got back in. I think the real killer was Aetherworks Marvel. I think that the like blue, white, green, black pre-Felidar Guardian format was tolerated pretty well. Felidar Guardian was kind of like a one-off, but Marvel was just like, oh my god. That was it, I think. I think that was the full-on derail of everything, and like it went, what, Marvel into more energy bands into, like, Goblin Chain Whirler with, like, a very brief period in there where people were actually playing a good format into, like, Nexus of Fate. And then, like, the Glimpse of Hope at GRN. But at that point, the format's already derailed and you have announced the Pro Tour is, like, vaguely sunsetting into the nebulous MPL and people are just, like, adrift and don't care at that point.
Yeah, Marvel was not a good time. And I think that that stretch of Saheeli, Felidar Guardian into, oh wait, this is going to stay legal for a month, into, oh wait, just kidding, no it's not, after people have already bought those cards for their upcoming Standard tournament, into Marvel, into everything else, I think it just progressively destroyed that sense of trust over time, which you need to have for a format like Standard, where you already know when you sign up for it that my investment, such as it is, it's going to, you know, it has this expiry date on it to some degree, but at least for that period of however many months it is, I'm going to have a good standard deck. I'm going to have these cards that I can use. And once that stopped being true, once the management of the format went out the window and just the nature of the format, the gameplay as well, took a nosedive, it, like, that ability to talk yourself into it just wasn't really there. And once that goes, what else are you going to do instead, right? And at the point where the game itself places so many other demands on your time and money, where if you're not playing Standard, you can play Modern, you can play Commander, I think. Like, the Rise of Commander is not a small part of this story either. Then I could build a Modern deck, which, in theory at least, is going to be somewhat sustainable over time. Or I could buy Standard cards, which, if I'm lucky, are going to be good for their entire theoretical, like, 12 to 18 month lifespan, but probably not even then.
Yeah, you also brought up a good thing that I sort of had forgotten in the timeline, was the Oops Felidar ban, after it not being banned. Basically, that same thing happened with Marvel, where they should have banned it in, there was that stack of, like, Smuggler Copter, Emrakul, and Reflector Mage that got banned. And, like, they just, like, Marvel was a problem. People knew Marvel was a problem, and it just escaped that ban to ruin the form. Like, people were, I don't know, that was probably it. That was the turning point.
Yeah, I think in terms of how do you get interest back in Standard now, I think it's a lost cause. I don't think you can. I think the kind of veil of this is a thing that we've all agreed to do and participate in, like, you just can't bring that down again. But you could force it, I suppose. You could say, okay, the next Premier level tournament in 6 months is Standard. The qualifying round for that is Standard. The RC that you're playing towards is Standard, and try and give it a real nudge that way. But then there's some kind of a causality problem here, where if there's no existing interest in Standard, how many stores are going to want to sign up for that, knowing that their initial Standard RCQs are going to get like a dozen people or whatever, and they're going to take a massive loss on those. You need every level of the operation to be on board, and you can decide as a top level of that you're on board, but you can't force the other levels to have much of an interest unless there's some amount of that there already, I think.
Yeah, and I think that this also suffers from, like, the arena decklist inertia problem, where, like, there are points in the recent history of bad standards where people were actually excited about the format and wanted to play it, and it looked good. Because there were a lot of people trying each week to break the format, and, like, I want to point to Theros Beyond Death Standard, where it was the Mr. Burns all the viruses at once joke, where it was like, yes, Wilderness Reclamation and Nissa and Cat Oven and Teferi and every card you could ever imagine hating are all legal. Somehow it worked out. Like, people, like, played different decks every week and different decks were winning because, like, people had a reason and everyone saw the deck list and they were like, oh, cool, I could play all these decks. We don't have that right now. If you start up any tournament setting on Arena, you're not going to generate that, in part because the field, like, doesn't fill. I don't know. This is the whole field filtering thing, and, like, having good players play against good players for stuff that matters. And also just the standard format certainly looks like it is not in any shape to provide that kind of interest. Looking at the latest challenge results of Grixis, 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 Mardu, Grixis, 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 Grixis.
Yes. Maybe just the existence of Arena is part of this story too, where in a world where if you want to play Standard, if you're one of those people, you can bite into Arena for however much that costs you, and whenever you complain about the cost, you will get people in your mentions claiming that actually it's free to play, and all you need to do is draft for 48 hours straight, and you'll have all the wildcards you need. But regardless of the actual economics behind that, I think it psychologically is hard to talk people into, well, you already own this deck on Arena, went to the work to craft this deck and so on, and you can play that at your convenience whenever you have a spare moment, versus you now also need to go and obtain those physical cards and paper when your ability to actually use those, like, maybe you can make it out to every other FNM or something, and maybe there's a local PPTQ near you. That is much more limited, especially with more demands on people's time. And so I think just forcing people to buy in multiple times, like, they're going to have to make a choice, and they're probably not going to choose paper at that point.
I mean, yeah, that has been a big thing that I have wrestled with approaching Magic this last year, in terms of, like, well, you can just play online and learn all the things online, or you can go to this event. And it's like, I don't know. Yeah, there's a lot of events where it's just like, you look at them and it's, what was the example of, like, the 8-person PTQ that paid out in, like, the demo packs or whatever, some absolute nonsense like that. Or you could just, like, not go. I think that, like, there's a lot of just, you know, with the lack of OP in these big events that are driving people to places to do things necessarily with standardized outcomes and payouts, like, that's a big hurdle to get people to clear.
Yeah, so a lot going on there. Don't claim to have all the answers ourselves, but some food for thought at the very least. With that, let's move on to the Brothers War, a set which I was hotly anticipating, like, when they announced it, just in terms of a lore perspective. And also, I think there's this kind of a frisson of danger that runs through any artifact-themed set, just given the history of Mirrodin and Kaladesh and some of these other sets, where you see these cards which either look very dangerous at first glance, but turn out to be pretty tame when all is said and done, or they seem pretty tame, and then actually the sparks all come together and something truly broken emerges from it. So very excited to see what this set had in store. And I think there's a lot to think about here, even if I think the actual, like, yield of playable cards for each format is going to be a lot lower than that by the end.
Yeah, I mean, they certainly sold that broken aspect of this being, like, scary and interesting. Is just, like, if you look at the set symbol, it is the gear symbol from Urza Saga split in half as, like, the Brothers War, which I think, we have talked a lot about all these other things. The set symbol game that they've had for a while has been absolutely top notch for the last few years. So, everything, ignore everything else. Like, whoever designs the set symbols that goes on the cards, great job. They aren't paying you enough. Continue on.
Mm-hmm. So with that, let's start with the Pioneer focused cards here. And within that, let's start with the reprints. And also side prints or side grades, I suppose, where we have a pair of removal spells here. We have an actual reprint in Go for the Throat. And then we also have this strict upgrade to Lava Coil in the form of Obliteration Box. So this is 1 in a red, 4 damage to a creature or a planeswalker, and whatever dies that way gets exiled. So Lava Coil, already a staple removal spell of the format, and this is a welcome upgrade to that. And then Go for the Throat in a format that has, you know, Heartless Act and, you know, various Doomblade variants. This, for the most part, is the best one of those, unless this set has a much bigger impact on the format than we're expecting at present.
Yeah, I'm extremely excited for Obliteration, both of these two, more than Go for the Throat. I think just the direct lineup with Old Growth Troll is huge for the format. Like, more than anything else going on here, I just want to have a 2-mana spell that exiles that and just move on with my life. Go for the Throat, also just, like, a very powerful, very generically good card. I like that it feels like the spell that you could put into the format the most that changes people's opinions and evaluations. Like, because that card exists, I think that maybe Scrap Heap Scrounger is not quite where you want to be, but, like, that is now on the list of interesting and playable cards as a result.
Yeah, or if it's ever legal to play in Soul Artifact again, then that's going to be a big point in its favor. And with Obliteration Bolt, people were already turning to Lava Coil against Mono Green to hit Old Growth Troll and some of these smaller creatures there, and having a version of that effect that also can snipe a Khan that Wish or something, or combine with an attack to actually take down a Kiora, which felt like an impossible task otherwise, I think is very welcome as well. So I don't think it's a game changer, really, but I think if your deck wanted this effect before, then you kind of knew that, but if your deck had Lava Coil, then definitely upgrade those into these. another reprint that is very funny coming off the immediate heels of Liliana entering the format is Obstinate Bailoff, which used to be more of a go-to card against red aggro, but red aggro doesn't really exist in the same form anymore, and insofar as it does, it's in a form which is fairly immune to Obstinate Bailoff, actually, and it's more as a way to snipe anyone audacious enough to like play a Croaster against you, for example.
Yeah, I am fairly medium on Obstinate Bailoff. I think that you kind of highlighted the best case, which is like, if there is a red aggro deck that is trying to kill you with damage and not an Embercleave, which deals 8 million damage, I think that Bailoff is a very good option there because it has those sideways uses against Kroxa, but I am not putting a card like Bailoff in my sideboard to beat Liliana the Veil. That's just like not how things operate.
It is very funny to me that you can use a removal spell on their Graveyard Trespasser and then put Bailoff into play off the wall trigger.
Oh, okay. I'm a little more excited about that.
Yeah, so sometimes you get to use this even if they're trying to play around it and not give you that opportunity. The final reprint that I want to mention here is Fauna Shaman. So this is one in a green for a 2/2. You can play green and tap and discard a creature card to search your library for another creature card, put it into your hand. So it's a kind of a one-time per use survivor of the fittest attached to a creature. First seen back in the day in M11. Saw a decent amount of play in that standard format and that small extended format. What do you make of its prospects here in Pioneer?
Well, a lot of that has to do with the fact that I believe it was released in the set. Was it the set after Vengevine was printed that it was released? Like, that's a pretty big duo. There is no Vengevine in Pioneer. I would have to look back at the, what was the, like, Ross Merriam style, like, Prized Amalgam, Haunted Dead decks from, I don't know, was that 2020 after the bannings and everything? Yeah, this was before Inverter, in that, like, weird, almost like non-existent period of the format where there were no longer bans at 3 p.m. on Monday, but like also there was Theros Beyond Death about to ruin the entire format. I am skeptical that there is a really good graveyard toolbox for it there. I'm very skeptical of Fauna Shaman as like an actual toolbox card a la like Birthing Pod or Survival, just because of the whole fragility and not having haste issue. And Elvish Archdruid is still not in the format, so I don't quite know where Elves is going. That would be the other big gap.
Yeah, I think it maybe does have a home in Elves, even though that deck has more 2-drops already than it can realistically play, just because I feel like you get into a lot of both matchups and board states with that deck, where all you care about is finding that lethal Shaman of the Pack to push through that final burst of damage, and this is the card that finds you Shaman of the Pack in a way that is more reliable, more efficient than something like a Collected Company or Call of Calling, for example.
Yeah, that's very fair, and it's also a card that if you are applying it in that kind of usage where it's like, well, if I have this card, it lets me do these things in these projected game states, you aren't looking to play a ton of Fauna Shaman, and it is not the best card in multiples. Like, there's the whole thing where, like, if you draw two Fauna Shaman, you can discard Fauna Shaman to Fauna Shaman to get what you want. But then, like, that's just two cards in your hand that aren't one drops getting you anywhere for the rest of the game.
And then beyond that, we can move on to the actual new cards being offered by this set. And the ones that have gained the most interest, naturally, are the various Khan Toolbox cards on offer here. We're going to save those for a kind of en masse discussion towards the end of the Pioneer segment here. For now, though, let's get into, I guess, whatever you like. What are some of the cards that caught your eye here?
I just want to start at the top. The card that excites me the most is, like, from this list of Pioneer sort of exclusives, is Portal to Phyrexia. So this is the 9-mana artifact with ETB, your opponent sacks 3 creatures, and at the beginning of your upkeep, you just get to reanimate a creature. That card's really good. In Modern, it's probably just worse than Archon of Cruelty anytime you could put a permanent onto the battlefield. I don't really foresee myself casting Shape Anew over Creativity or whatever, but, like, I think Portal in Pioneer is extremely powerful, and I think that it's probably still pending publication at the time that this... depending on when this releases, we'll see. But I basically wrote an article highlighting this in context of the white reanimation spells in Pioneer that can target an artifact, also with another card I'll get to later. There's two Brothers of War cards, I think, that are going to be reasons to move towards a more broken version of some of the white decks that we've seen. But, like, Refurbish exists, and Invoke Justice exists. And both of those are great ways to put a portal into play. And then I think the other important piece of this equation is that you get to pair Fable of the Mirror Breaker and Restoration of Aganjo as two really powerful discard outlets that are just, like, fair cards whenever you don't draw a portal. Like, if you just draw a hand that has Fable and, like, Restoration and, like, Invoke Justice with nothing to reanimate, those are all just totally fine cards to draw and cast at some point.
Yeah, Invoke Justice is a very impressive card that is hard to find a home for exactly. So if you've managed to do that, you have my attention for sure. It, in theory, does pair with Creativity, but the issue there is, in your Creativity deck, what exactly are you returning with Portal every turn? Unless you can build some kind of Creativity deck that, like, I don't know, finds a creature up front and then can reliably Creativity that, but that seems like a lot of hoop to jump through. But yeah, the whole Refurbish, Invoke Justice family of cards seems like a great starting point.
Yeah. Oh, and the other thing too is that this is a Yorion deck, and I literally cannot imagine ever losing with Yorion and Portal. Like, you play Yorion, you flicker Portal, all their stuff dies. If Yorion ever dies, you get it back and then you flicker your Portal. Like, it's just over. It's done. Like, they're dead forever.
That is exactly the kind of Magic I want to be playing. I will highlight a maybe more mainstream mid-range card here in Misery Shadow. So this is the attempt 20 years later to finally make Hantuko Shade playable in contemporary Magic. It was a little sad to me when the original Dominaria cycle of these triple pip cards with all of these throwbacks, like Goblin Chainweller, format-defining card, you know, Tempest Djinn, Banalish Marshal, Steel Leaf Champion, all very popular, all very successful, and then Dread Trade was comically unplayable. It was embarrassing if you ended up putting that card in a deck. So it's nice that we finally have what may be a successful attempt at that. This is one and a black for a 2/2. If a creature an opponent controls would die, exile it instead, and then you can pay one colorless, crucially, not black, to give Misery Shadow +1/+1 until end of turn. So I'm thinking about just generic Rakdos midrange as a deck which doesn't have that much good to do on two mana, to the point where you see these random, like, Tenacious Underdogs or whatever creeping in from time to time. And in that context, this kind of gives you what you wanted from Kalitas as a 4-drop in terms of the static ability, and then is, like, a pretty good mana sink that can almost always attack in a way that's hard to block just as a fair card as well.
Yeah, no, I really like that. I think that my one caveat to all this discussion is that if you are playing a Rakdos Mirror match, you are legally obligated to cast this card after turn two. I cannot imagine a worse outcome than it getting stomped. Like, you don't even get the blood token reward. Like, yeah, your Harvester gets stomped and then you have a token and, like, you know, there's some... It's just done. So, like, don't do that. But yeah, I really endorse this card. I think that the... Something that I remember from playing with Hantuko Shade that probably no one else ever remembers who stopped, you know, if you started playing after literally 2003 in, like, I think literally about July, like that time frame, you don't really appreciate how fast Hantuko Shade kills people. Like, this card will just do, like, 5, then 6, then 7 over 3 turns, like, if you wanted to, and that is 18 damage. Like, your opponent is not taking a lot of hits from this and surviving. And I think that is exactly what Rakdos wants. Like, it is, like, your opponent is going to die to Misery Shadow very quickly. The problem with Rakdos is when its cards are like Kalidus, where they just don't kill your opponent quickly. And if their abilities don't matter, then, like, what is your deck doing? Like, this card is just going to matter.
I think this might also let you upgrade your Kalidus, so to speak, to the 4-drop that does combine well with this in terms of adding up to 20 quickly, which is Shielded, where now that you have the unique selling point of Kalitas mostly spoken for in the same way, you get to play the 4-drop, which I think abstractly is a lot more powerful. And the fact that that effect is this much cheaper means that, for example, against Mono Green, even if they have the turn 2 Orgrowth Troll start, well, you can keep up with that. You can curve, you know, Shadow into Dreadborn, not giving them anything back, or when they finally play their Cavalier of Thorns, like, it's easy to kind of double spell with this and Dreadball or something in the same turn. So I think that this card is... I don't know if you can play it as a 4-of, because there are some diminishing returns there, and, you know, we mentioned with Evolve Sleeper in the last set, maybe you could build a low-to-the-ground Rakdos deck with that just has a lower curve that focusing on that card. Turns out no one actually did that, but maybe this is what we were kind of gesturing towards there.
Yeah, I think the big difference is that Evolve Sleeper is not actually that fast at killing people. It just lets you put your mana somewhere to do a thing, whereas this card just puts the mana directly into killing your opponent. Ready to move on to the next card? I've got a quick one, if we are. So, Soul Partition. This is the one in a white where you effectively, like, ransom something. This is, like, the mechanic that you see with... it was ransom on one of the, like, what are they called? Playtest cards from the Mystery Boosters. So this is, and I want to compare this card specifically to Fateful Absence. So let me just pull up the exact text of Soul Partition here. It's one in a white for a instant, exile target, non-land permanent. Its owner may cast it by paying two more than it costs, at any time from now on. So this is like, it's like the elite Spellbinder mechanic for something on the battlefield. This card is just worse than Fateful Absence basically every time, right? Because it's like every time they crack the clue on Fateful Absence, this just like, they just read with this card, they just redraw the card you killed. So, or maybe am I like viewing it wrong? Is this supposed to be like, you're supposed to use it as effectively like a way to kill something cheap, like a, you know, a smother style effect where you're like, okay, I'm going to kill your two drop. And it's better that you don't have a clue because the card you draw is always that same junky two drop. I don't know. I'm skeptical, but I do want to like talk about that second application.
Yeah, there is the hidden third mode of saving your own thing and then having to pay this additional cost for it later on. But yeah, I have close to zero interest in this card in Constructed, I think.
Yeah, well, the thing you're describing there is basically paying four mana for a raise debt. So I'm kind of off that.
Yeah, so I personally am off every part of this card, I think. Let's move on to one which I am a lot more confident in it seeing play, and that's Recruitment Officer. So this is white for a 2-1, the latest in our family of elite vanguards and Savannah Lions and so on. And its text is 3 and a white, look at the top 4 cards of your deck. You can reveal a creature with mana value 3 or less from among those, put it into your hand. So this is, I guess, the Spectral Sailor of the Mono White Humans deck.
I wouldn't even say that. I think that the problem there, and the problem with a lot of these cards like this, is Spectral Sailor is a little different because when the Spirits deck leaves up 4 mana, it actually has a play in Geistlet Snare that will interact with your opponent's card on the stack, or like Spellqueller. So like you end up in these spots where like if your opponent with Sailor, you're putting your opponent in a spot where if they do something, they lose their card. And if they don't do something, you're up a card. The white decks have none of that parity. Like, your opponent is just going to slam whatever they have into it, and you're going to be like, I'm going to keep coming back to Azika's Chariot, because it's just the most obvious example of, like, what's going on here. It's like, okay, you know, Sky Sovereign, Azika's Chariot, and you're like, okay, I'll pay 4 mana and draw a card. That's, okay, I'm dead. I think that this card is totally acceptable for, you know, if your opponent shows up with Azorius and is like, trying to cast Farewell and you can just leave up your mana and draw a card there, that's fine. I don't think it solves most of the other problems for the white decks. It does have good types. I do want to highlight this is a soldier. There is a pretty powerful soldier payoff in the land section of this set in Fortified Beachhead. This is along the lines of like the Lorwyn creature type lands. It's a blue-white land that is untapped if you reveal a soldier, or in this case, control a soldier, which is really good. It's basically just an untapped white land in your white deck, and then it has 5 tap. Is it your soldiers get +1 or all your creatures? Either way, it doesn't really matter. Like, this is like Shefet Dunes that is painless and also potentially fixes.
Yeah, big Wonderwine Hub vibes from back of the day. I think that the soldiers tribal stuff in the set is something to look at. There's also this 3-drop Sea Treaderon. So this is a 2/2 for a human soldier. At the beginning of combat on your turn, you put a +1/+1 counter on something, so the Luminarch Aspirant text, effectively, and then whenever another non-token soldier you control dies, you create a 1/1 colorless soldier artifact creature token. I think that card specifically probably is not there, and the fact that it's another non-token soldier, so if this gets stomped, you don't even get anything in return. I think that probably shuts this one out, but there might be a soldier deck you can build where I think it has to be human soldiers. I think that Thalia's Left Hand as a lord is just so powerful that you can't afford to give that up. But if you can get into that overlap where you have the 2-drop soldier lord, Valiant Vanguard, I think, from DMU, and then you get a bunch of other stuff too, then I think there might be a deck there.
Yeah, I mean, we speculated on this, I think, last set a bit, and the question was, like, are there enough decent filler soldiers? And recruitment, like, the problem was a lot of the one-drops are not great. It's like, I don't know, how many Soldier of the Pantheons do you want to play? Well, if some of them are recruitment officers, that's probably the start of an upgrade.
Yeah, so maybe a twist on the white aggro deck to look at there. Let's get on to Combat Courier. So this is a very innocuous little cog to look at. This is one mana for a 1/1. It has two and sacrifice it to draw a card, and then it has Unearth for blue. So in theory, you could play this outside of blue. In practice, this is going to be in some kind of blue artifact deck, but I don't know quite what that looks like exactly. Like if... again, I think in Soul Artifact is effectively soft banned by Khan the Great Creator, just being a staple in the most popular deck. But if and when that changes, does a deck like that even want an effect like this? I'm not quite sure.
This reads to me like a card that is in like some weird hybrid aggro combo deck. Like Artifact with Flashback of an Artifact is really interesting to me. And I think this actually... Let's just bridge this little discussion into another topic, which is called Pick an Urza, Pick a Mishra. And I would like to pick the 4-mana Urza. This is the rare one that is 2 white-blue. Your artifact creatures get +2/+2, and then you can pay, is it 5 or 6 to make a artifact soldier 1/1 token? There's Tempered Steel in this format now, and that's pretty impressive. And if you're going to be doing something like that, I think that this is kind of the spot where you might want to be combat couriering, where like it is a surefire thing that you can put on the battlefield. I don't know. Combat Courier is not the card that's going to make the deck work, but it's going to be a card that is going to show up if you are like artifact creature synergies, in my opinion.
Yeah, for 2/2 buff to everything, that is a lot. It sounds kind of flippant and obvious to say, but until you see that in action, it's like, if you have any kind of board presence, that just really puts you over the top and makes you basically impossible to block. I think if you're paying 4 mana, you need something of that magnitude for it to be worth it, especially in what tends to be like this lower to the ground deck, where previously like the blue white and soul decks were lower decks. They capped their curve at 2 and they were happy about it, and had a bunch of, you know, Mutavaults or other mana lands, ways to spend their mana. So spending 4 mana on a thing is no easy task, but this might be worth doing that. I don't know.
Yeah, it's definitely probably, I would view it more as just like the thing that is at the top of your curve is a 4 of, and the rest of your deck does stay in approximately that Lurrus range. I guess the other half of this, you know, so that's Urza, Prince of Krug over Lord Protector and Power Stone Prodigy. I think we're, are you in the same boat that the Meld Urza and the Uncommon one are like nothing to write home about? I think Pick a Mishra is kind of an interesting discussion, but I'll let you discuss if you like either of those other cards.
Well, Urza Lord Protector is kind of interesting to me, bearing in mind that I have effectively zero interest in melding it, but just the idea of a cost reduction on artifacts and instants and sorceries, I do wonder if there's some like paradoxical outcome deck or something where you can get useful cost reductions on 2 out of the 3 there.
I am very skeptical of that, because I think the most, I don't know, like, what are the mana artifacts that are setting you up to go anywhere with that in this format? I don't think that they exist in this format, and I think in older formats, like, I don't know if there really is a reason to be going to an Urza for that effect.
Yeah, I guess you have Mox Amber is the big one, where just this entire run of Magic sets is a pretty big boon to that card. Still not enough to make it crack into Pioneer, I expect, but, you know, Mox Amber finally having its day in the sun in Modern, and maybe... I don't think you want this Urza in a deck like that, but you can find other good Mox Amber uses if you are a Mox Amber enjoyer, I think.
Okay. Do you have any of the Mishras that you would like to highlight, or do we just kind of not like any of those?
I don't know if this is... reflective of the lore, but I think that Urza is going to win out over Mishra here once again.
Yeah, I can see some sideways uses for the rare Mishra as well. This is the one that grants your artifacts in graveyard unearth as just like the most efficient way to unearth a portal to Phyrexia, but even then, that's a fairly minimal version. It's just like the sacrifice. I don't know. I'm also of the opinion that Urza is the greater brother here.
There might be some place for the other half that melds with one of the Mishras, and that's a Phyrexian Dragon Engine. So this is 3 mana for a 2/2 artifact creature with double strike. When it ETBs from your graveyard, you can discard your hand, and if you do, you draw 3 cards. And it has Unearth for 3 and double red. So I'm thinking about this card in conjunction with stuff like a Goblin Engineer potentially in Modern, or we have a card that I'm pretty excited about just more generally in this set in Recommission. So this is 1 and a white. You return an artifact or creature with mana value 3 or less from your graveyard to play, and if it's a creature, it gets a +1/+1 counter. So the synergy there is kind of obvious, but Recommission more broadly, I think it's certainly in Pioneer, the cheapest version of that effect that we've seen. And in Modern, yeah, you have Unearth, but that's in a color which maybe you don't want to be playing in your deck, and maybe just Recommission being white goes some distance there. And then being able to get back an artifact. I don't have a very ambitious use for that in mind, potentially, but you can imagine some combo deck where just like, this recurs your Scrap Trawler or something, but also gets back an Ichor Wellspring or some other setup card.
Yeah, I am skeptical of, like, the low-impact reanimate spells that are not, like, hyper-mana efficient like Unearth, but that is getting close. I would like to make an argument for a different Mishra card as the best Mishra from the set, and that might be Mishra's Foundry. This is the colorless land, taps for colorless, 2 to animate it into a 2/2 artifact creature that is an assembly worker, and as one tap, target assembly worker gets +2/+2 until end of turn. I think that if you are going down the road of playing a bunch of Mishra's Factories, this card is really exciting as a way to make them really impressive threats. You know, Mishra's Factory does the pumping for free, but it's only +1 for the additional one. The sad part is there's not a lot of other assembly workers you would want to pump with this, but I can see worlds where, like, really layering up. I guess in Pioneer, you can play Mutavault as the best assembly worker of all time. So maybe, like, if your deck really wants 5 or 6 Mutavaults, this is a really good 5th or 6th Mutavault.
Yeah, I think in Pioneer, we have been very much spoiled by Mutavault, and often the decks that play Mutavault care about creature types as well, so that's another point in its favor. But I could imagine, yeah, a deck that just wants as many Mutavaults as they can get its hands on. Back when I was messing around with some of these artifact aggro decks, so not in Soul specifically, but like the Mishiko's Reign of Truth style decks and so on, they were built at that, but I quite happily would have just had as many colorless creature lands as I could play, and this is a nice addition to that roster. In a standard context, it's interesting because we've had a lot of these. We had this whole cycle of man lands and AFR that were format defining. We've had Faceless Haven, we've had some of these other options. So that has been a pretty constant part of standard over the past few years. But this is the first one in a while that is kind of a small investment for a small return, as opposed to something like a Den of the Bugbear or even Hall of Storm Giants, where you're spending potentially your entire turn on this, but you are justified in doing that. This is very much a, you know, it's kind of sitting there as an afterthought until it isn't, and until it suddenly becomes a relevant game piece.
Yeah, it feels like it's trying to operate like the step below Faceless Haven. And I will just briefly touch on standard in that I like adding this card to the format as a foil to the Triomes. I think that pairing is very important. It didn't work out so well last time and people just played a million Faceless Havens, but you know what? You can't win them all.
Well, I think the issue there was past a certain point, they couldn't play Faceless Haven anymore. And so once you get to 7-set or 8-set standard, you get to a point now where you kind of want to have something like that there as a counterweight to, you know, Rafine's Tower over here and Jemmy's Garden over there, and it just didn't really exist. And so, yeah, by the end, every deck was Esper or Jeskai or something like that, and, you know, having a reason to be in mono green or mono white, I think would have gone a long way.
Yeah, and I think that it's nice that this is a more balanced, like, the problem with Faithless Haven is that you are basically required to be monocolor, but, like, also, you can't really, like, I was like, oh yes, a deck that wants 6 Mutavaults, like, can your Faceless Haven deck play more creature lands than just Faceless Haven without wrecking your Faceless Havens? It's really dicey. Whereas this card doesn't really care about that. So, yeah, and your point about artifact aggro, really important. Don't put this card in an aggro deck with one drops that have colored mana cost. Cedric Phillips has a whole rant about the 4th Mutavault in the white deck. I don't know if he's necessarily 100% right. It may just be like you are playing a 4th Mutavault over what would not be a land, and it's just kind of like a spell that makes mana. But at the same time, just beware of that if you are not able to tap this for a one drop on turn one.
Yeah, on the subject of building mana bases for these aggro decks, let's touch on Lay Down Arms. So this is a kind of a spread through a bracket of sorts. This is white for a sorcery. You exile target creature with mana value less than or equal to the number of planes you control. Its controller gains 3 life. So you can start to visualize how the scales where, yeah, this is going to actually kill their Llanowar Elves on turn 1, but touch and go whether it's going to kill their Old-Growth Troll by turn 3, and then unless your mana base is entirely planed, which is something you can do, and you can even find these typed planes, so you can have a Boros deck or a Naya deck with a bunch of Sacred Foundries and Triomes and so on. For the most part, this is a appealing-ish way to place a pretty big restriction on your mana base in a world where, you know, most white decks these days are going to have that free Igandro Seed of the Empire, not so free in a world where that might be the difference between this card killing or not killing their most important creature.
Yeah, I kind of ran into that issue. I was building, I mentioned that mono white deck with, Portal Phyrexia and everything. I just ended up with Chained to the Rocks in my deck instead. It is, there's just like good lands that you would like to have in your deck. It's kind of a problem. I don't think there's a white deck in the format that doesn't want to have good lands. Just the lands in Pioneer are so good. Even if you don't get there is no white Den of the Bugbear. They forgot to print that card in the cycle.
Yeah, let's talk about a sideboard hoser, which kind of seems to be targeting two different varieties of combo decks at once, but it's unclear if it's actually good enough to handle either. And that's Calamity's Wake. So this is one and a white for an instant. You exile all graveyards. Players can't cast non-creature spells this turn, and then you exile Calamity's Wake. So there have certainly been decks in the past where both halves of this card are going to be good at the same time. Like, you cast this in response to a Parson Flames, you are really making sure that nothing is coming back from those flames. But these days, I think that you really care about one half of that card, and if the other half does anything, that's a cherry on top.
Yeah, we're talking about this here. I'm highly skeptical about it in Modern, and that's kind of why I like it here, because I don't want to pay mana for either of these effects in Modern. That's honestly where it's at. Like, I can pay 0 for Chalice for most of the times the Storm thing matters. I can pay 0 for Endurance most of the times the Graveyard thing matters. I'm kind of in a similar spot in Pioneer. Also, like, I don't know, what is the Graveyard deck? This is the, like, if this card was printed in 2006, this would have been the best card in Extended ever, because it beats Mind's Desire and Golgari Grave Troll. That's just not how Magic works these days. That's not where we're operating.
Yeah, we don't have to Burning Wish for Morningtide anymore, thankfully. But maybe the target for this is a deck like Phoenix, where you get their graveyard and you stop them from... Or I guess you could look at it the other way. You stop them from casting their Treasure Cruise this turn, and you also stop them from casting it next turn and bringing back some Phoenixes, while also hindering them in some other way. But I'm very skeptical of this. Like you said, I don't want to overpay for Silence. I certainly don't want to overpay for something like Tormund's Crypt or what have you. And I think this card just doesn't have an obvious target and doesn't really do enough against the decks that it's targeting.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing where, like, looking, the graveyard decks in this format are what, Obzon Greasefang, where, like, they are very proactive and very aggressive, and if you just sit around with 2 mana up, you're done. And Phoenix, where, like, if you just... What are you going to do? You're going to sit around with 2 mana up and, like, debate firing this off when they have 3 cards in their graveyard? Like, what's your plan to not just have them draw 3 cards with a Treasure Cruise at some point by tapping mana? Like, if you're double stone running yourself for this, where are you getting?
Let me talk to you about Bitter Reunion. So this is a twist on... not Cathartic Reunion, but... whatever, 20 voice, I suppose. So this is one and a red for an enchantment. When it ETBs, you may discard a card, and if you do, you draw 2 cards, and then you can pay 1 and sacrifice Bitter Reunion to give all creatures you control haste until end of turn. So as someone who is very often thinking about Enigmatic Incarnation, that's where my mind immediately jumped with this. And I think in that deck, it serves a few interesting roles, where, first of all, it's a good 2 mana like card filtering effect that lets you replace Omen of the Sea, and that in turn means you don't really need blue mana early anymore, and you're leaning into red, which in a deck that already has Chain to the Rocks and Fires of Invention and so on, you kind of have a lot of mountains by default. So that lets you be this predominantly Naya deck that is incidentally splashing one or maybe the second color on top of that as well. And then the second half is no joke either, where... you are a Fabled Mirrorbreaker deck, and one issue is often there's a big wait between you transforming Fable into Reflection Kihijiki and being able to activate Reflection. Now that threat can just come out of nowhere, where you can turn your Reflection online, which in turn can double up on whatever utility creature you searched for last turn, or there will be times where like you have fires in play and you already have this, and you just cast two things and immediately get an attack in. So I think this card is kind of useful at all phases of the game, and also just naturally is a good thing, you know, is a good 2-drop to turn into your 3-drop when it comes to that.
Yeah, I really like this card, and I could even see playing it in Modern. I think you'd have to do some rework on the way the Dredge decks are built, because there's not a lot of creatures that you necessarily want to give haste. But there is, like, a pretty decent history of, like, Flamekin Zealots and Dredge, admittedly during the Bridge from Below era, but I think that if you did a bit of work, you could make a Dredge deck where the haste ability on this was a really relevant thing.
There is a Nonsense of the Week candidate from this week, which is a Dredge deck that has a creature that is very much worth giving haste to.
That's true. We will get to that. And that deck also would, like, if you can find an excuse to play this card, that deck would love to have another, like, 2 to 3 copies of, it's not quite Cathartic Reunion, but, like, I don't know. It's really hard to bring yourself to play Thrill of Possibility in Modern. Maybe, like, you can cross that line with this card.
Mm-hmm. Where do you want to go to next?
I think that I want to talk about, I don't know, we've sort of mentioned the various prototype cards last week, but I just want to really, really hype up Combat Thresher. That card seems awesome to me. Just really amazing.
Yeah, this was the 2 and a white, 1/1, double strike, ETB draws a card, and if you cast it for 7, it's a 3/3, I believe, at base. Lots of ways to get good value from that early and then turn it into a really serious threat later on, and very often without paying the 7 mana upfront in order to do that.
Yeah, and then like all these decks that would be avoiding this cost in some way are also just like the exact Yorian decks that want to cast a 3-mana cantrip thing that just draws you a card later, and then also are, like, potentially playing a lot of games where you hit your 7th land, and then you just cast the big mode of this. I'm just really excited to play with this card.
Yeah, you think about those, like, mono-white or white-red Yorian decks where I can imagine not just Yorian blinking this, but even stuff like I cast this on 3, I try and trade it with something or it eats a removal spell, and then, you know, my turn 5 Elspeth Conqueror's Death buys this back as a 4/4 double strike that draws a card on turn 7 or something. Like there are lots of ways to really get full value out of this.
Yeah, this is definitely my pick for the best one of these in Pioneer. In Modern there might be some different choices, but in Pioneer I'm a big fan of that. I guess let's talk about a different card that was added to this format, Brushland, and specifically Brushland with Audacity. This is really just lining up with Glade Cover Scout, and I think that Audacity, this is the sort of Rancor green plus 2+0 and trample, and when the creature dies, you draw a card. Do you foresee a future for this style of deck in the format?
I actually really do, yeah, and this is you know, we mentioned Auras as a deck which was kind of hovering on the fringes, and then I think Liliana of the Veil shut the door on any lingering hopes of that. But I think you can get into a spot against a deck like Rakdos with your Auras deck where they need to have exactly Liliana, and if they don't, then they are dead to rights. And being able to support Glade Cover Scout and Slippery Bogle, or I guess not Slippery Bogle, but exactly Glade Cover Scout is a big part of that.
Yeah, I feel like there's like one, I mean, there's Disciple of Purifying or Apostle of Purifying Light. This is the 1 and a white 2/1 pro black that hits stuff in graveyards from M20. I think that would be a totally acceptable card if you're going down that road, or like something along those lines where you're just like leaning into the fact that you don't really care about hexproof. You just care about protection from these exact colors and not the colors that you are putting your auras on your creature with.
Yeah, the issue in Pioneer is not really the auras. Like, you have Ethereal Armor, you have all the glitters, you have all of these different one-mana auras that fleshes out your Light Paws toolbox, but you kind of need something like this to get over the line. Or really you need, maybe it's Brushland more so than this, but like, if you didn't have this, you just had Brushland, you could substitute a card like Griftspoon, for example, for this and get most of the way there. But the fact that you have this, and then also you now have semi-functional manner, you really still wish you had Rage of Ultraliquid. Like, this is the most glaring difference in Pioneer mana bases, and one which, when we go to Phyrexia for officially for the next set, well, maybe that cycle of I guess what became new Phyrexia dual lands is like thematically on brand again, so maybe we can go back there.
Yeah, especially because the other good Hexproof creature is Bosra Tower Archers, and that mana ain't working out with a pathway.
Yes. I think one of the big draws to green in terms of auras was actually Warbriar Blessing from Theros Beyond Death. So this is the one in a green, enchanted creature gets +0/+2, and when it ETBs, enchanted creature fights up to one target creature you don't control. So this lets Lightpause and any 2-mana aura fight down a creature, which in a deck which previously could make a really, really big creature, but not really interact with an opposing one, that is a big game. And so, you know, if your Phoenix opponent has a thing in the ice or something which is going to undo all of your hard work, well, this now means that if you can line that up properly, you can now fight that down. And same goes for, you know, even just sniping a Llanowar Elf, right, against mono green can really change the clock there. So there are draws to green over and above this new card, but I think Audacity and specifically Brushland are what let you start to consider that once again.
Yeah, and I actually think that there's another piece of this puzzle here, which is specifically Lightpause plus Unflinching Courage into the Warbriar's Blessing. Like, that is a really powerful setup. So just to remind everyone, Lightpause is from Kamigawa Neon Dynasty. It's when an aura ETBs under your control after you cast it, you search for a aura with mana value less than it and a name that you don't control. So you go Unflinching Courage, which is the 1GW +2/+2 trample lifelink. And you can suit up a creature, then immediately find the blessing, and then fight with your now pumped lifelink creature to kill something. That's a really good setup.
Yeah, I believe this card also just has a typo on it. Like, you don't draw a card, you just draw a card.
What?
I saw some discussion of this, and when I searched on Scryfall, like, yeah, the picture you get, you just draw a card. I don't know what else to tell you.
You know, they gotta save words on cards any way they can these days to put other words on the same card.
Yeah, that real estate is very precious, for sure. One card that kind of caught my eye, but I don't know where I'm going to put it, is Kayla's Reconstruction. So this is this new riff on Genesis Wave, I suppose. X and triple white for a sorcery. You look at the top 7 cards of your library, and you put up to X artifact and or creature cards with mana value 3 or less from among those into play, and put the rest on the bottom of your library in a random order. So I think this is a powerful effect that I don't think you can do that much powerful with, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so I think I want to bring up the first point with this card is that if you are not casting this for X=3 reliably, this is not, like, compare this to Collected Company, right? I don't know if I really want to find a bunch of jumbled artifacts with this. That said, it's not, like, horrible to cast it for 2 if you have the dream of casting it for 3 a reasonable amount of time. So I would view this as, like, a 5-drop that can scale up effectively. But from there, I think you need to be reaching the point where you are casting this for 3 or 4 or 5 and reliably hitting that many permanents. I haven't done the math on that. That's a fairly tough ask, depending on the number of land you have. But also, like, the Collected Company math is diluted a lot by the fact that it has to literally be creatures, as opposed to, like, I don't know, there's enough ways to find artifacts to fill your other slots to do this job. That's just kind of voicing all the technical concerns. I haven't figured out where I want to play this.
Yeah, I think it's tough to put it in a creature deck because the difference between 4 mana and 5 mana or even 6 mana is very big, and I don't know where you get that additional mana from unless you're trying to be some Llanowar Elves, Elvish Mystic deck that's building towards this, but then the mana there just is completely impossible even once we do have a Rage of Ultraliquid.
Yeah, you need like Avacyn's Pilgrim and more.
Yeah, so maybe there's some artifact deck where, like, Inspiring Statuary curves into this pretty nicely, but then this can also find the Statuary if that's the thing you need to tie the room together.
And then you're, what, playing some X spell that is also fine to put into play with this so that you have enough hits?
I hadn't thought that far ahead, no.
Yeah, like, I just want to put out some numbers there. With 32 hits in your deck for this, which is literally 24 lands, 4 of this, and then all hits, your X=3 still misses, like,
Urstil doesn't hit three things like a sixth of the time. So that the diminishing returns math on this card is actually kind of dicey.
Yeah, but maybe not on that one then. Unless you have anything else that you're eyeing for specifically Pioneer, we can move on to maybe some of the modern specific cards or the cards which could just dip their toe in multiple formats.
I think I want to have the Karn discussion here because I think the Karn discussion is certainly most relevant for this format because I don't really love most of the Karn targets for Modern, with one like vague exception with... we'll get to that in this discussion briefly, but... I think I want to talk about the slam dunk Karn target first off, which is Cityscape Leveler. This is the 8-mana giant creature with Unearth that has, when you cast it or when it attacks, destroy a permanent and then they make a power stone token. I believe it's non-land permanent, correct?
Yes, and crucially, it's when you cast it, it's the Eldrazi-style text, and so even if this gets countered or interfered with on the stack in some way, you still get your Vindicate out of that. So this is a nice upgrade to Meteor Golem out of the sideboard of Mono Green Devotion or some of these other Karn decks. And often when you wish for Meteor Golem, it was because you had to more than because you wanted to. And the 3-3 body felt like laughably obsolete as soon as it came into play. This is a real finisher. This is a very real threat. And often you'll find yourself wishing for this, I think, even if you don't have anything that you really care about destroying, just because, well, I do destroy something, but now I also have this 8/8 that is threatening to destroy future things when it attacks and also can come back for more at a later date.
Yeah, just a slam dunk. You just get to turn a vaguely utility sideboard slot into like utility plus also just a good thing to find. So yeah, really slam dunk. The other ones I'm a little dicier on. I guess let's talk about Woodcolor Automaton first. This is the prototype creature from the not actually in this set, but also in the format. Jumpstart cards. This is 2 green-green for a 3/3, or is it 10 mana for an 8/8? That's just like an absurd amount. But when it ETBs, you untap a land you control. It makes the land into a creature with the same size as Woodcolor Automaton's power. So this is where the scaling comes in. So it's, you know, 4 mana 3/3 that makes a 3/3, or 10 mana 8/8 that makes an 8/8, gives the land haste. But importantly, it's just like if you can Karn for a way to untap Nykthos that's reasonably profitable, and I believe the mana cost works out properly, that it adds to Nykthos Devotion. That said, I don't know exactly what the situations are where you want to Karn for an untap on Nykthos. I will leave that to the mono-green mathematicians to whiteboard that all out and then like hand everyone the cheat sheet as to where you find this card.
Yeah, I don't know exactly how often that's going to come up or when it lets you combo off when you couldn't do it without this card, but I think those spots will come up enough, or you will find yourself just wanting this effect via Karn enough that it's going to earn one of those 15 cherished sideboard slots there. One card that I think will not, and I think this is a trap that you'll see people fall into at first, is the Stasis Coffin. So this is 3 mana for a legendary artifact. You can pay 2, tap and exile the Stasis Coffin. You gain protection from everything until your next turn. So you cannot be targeted or damaged or anything like that. So on the surface, it seems like, well, this lets your Karn kind of protect you and protect itself until the next turn, where you have all of your mana, you get another Karn activation, and this can just bridge you seamlessly to that. The big issue there being that Karn itself does not gain protection from everything. So what you're going to find is you have shielded yourself, but if they were attacking Karn in the first place, and I'm sure that's what they want to do, well, now you're down a Karn, or if your Kiora is vulnerable, that can get attacked too. And so you've kind of bought a turn, but you spent your best card to do it, and you haven't really gained anything in the process.
Yeah, not great. Don't love it. Maybe vaguely okay against combo decks, but I'd rather get the next card, which is the Stone Brain, for that, if that's what I wanted. Or I'd rather just get, like, a Damping Sphere or a Tormod Script, which I think is the problem with the Stone Brain, is that it's hard to imagine a combo deck where you want this card and not just, like, a dedicated hate card. And it's just kind of a... if there's enough combo decks that aren't hit by Karn, that this is the catch-all... I don't know. It's a really specific scenario where it's like, there are 6 combo decks in the format. This card beats 3 of them, and therefore you get to spend 1 cyber card on them all. But also, none of those combo decks actually just, like, loses to a Karn to start. So, really don't like that scenario. Do like this card in Modern for a couple specific purposes. One, it is an on-pace Unmoored Ego. Like, it is a turn three activation for a lot of decks that previously couldn't cast Ego. So that's kind of interesting. But I also like the idea that this is a way to sideboard into something you cascade into as a hate card. Kind of adorable.
Oh, okay. I hadn't even thought about that angle. I think that's going to run into the same issue that it does with Khan, just carried across to a different format, where if you look at the Pioneer example, most of the linear decks that you want this effect against Greasefang, for example, yeah, you could eventually end up stonebraining their Greasefangs on their Barhelions or something. In the short term, you probably want to get Tormod's Crypt just for the kind of double layer of protection immediately. And then if you get to untap with Khan, well, you're probably at the point then where you don't even need or want the Stonebrain anymore. And then some of these other combo decks, you run into this question of, well, maybe there's nothing I can get with Khan right away, but then if I can untap with Khan, or I get to untap and cast whatever I wished for, there's a more like generic anti-combo card that does a job, whether it's, you know, Godfarer's Statue or something like that. So you need to be in that sweet spot in between where this card is the thing you want that does what no other card can do, but it's also fast enough in that you can expect to Khan for the Stonebrain and get to use it. So one example might be against like the Creativity decks, for example. If you land a fast Khan, you Khan, you wish for the Stonebrain, and now they are effectively in check, because if you get to untap, or you're braining all of their creativities or all of their creativity payoffs, and their deck just doesn't really function anymore. So decks, these kind of slower but more flexible combo decks like that, I think the ones that are going to be hurt most by this card. Or you can think of something like the Jeskai Ascendancy combo deck, where that deck can actually very easily combo off through something like a Godfarer's Statue or a Devouring Sphere. Can't combo off if it has no Jeskai Ascendancies left, for example. So there are decks like that, which for now are mostly on the fringes, but between them are perhaps popular enough that a card like this can just disable them completely. The other thing too is that this card makes the mono-green mirrors even more swinging and even more miserable, because previously there were these symmetrical effects that you could get to disable the opponent's comboing ability. So you could Pithing Needle their Khan, and those games where you had shut off both players' Khans were these obscure edge cases that were important sometimes, and you had to figure out when that was. Or you could do stuff like Damning Sphere to shut off Nykthos or stuff like that. But this is the first asymmetric and aggressively casted way to shut the opponent out of the game via Khan. So it's not implausible to, you know, turn four, for example, play Khan with four mana floating off Nykthos, get the Stonebrain, cast it, use it, take out all of their Khans or their Nykthoses or something, and effectively lock up the game on the spot. However, if they have a Khan, well, now your Stonebrain has no text, it doesn't do anything, and so you have to find some way to either remove their Khan or to, get something else to get you out of that situation. And so there's now even more of a premium to being on the play, to having that fast Khan, and that lets you just take the opponent's knees out from underneath them. But then you get to this next level step of, if your opponent has Khan and you have a Nicol Bolas in your deck, what you can do is Nicol Bolas as their Khan, Khan for Pithing Needle, Needle their Khan, and now you still get to piggyback off their Khan on the following turn with Nicol Bolas, and then maybe you can get your own Stonebrain, or you can get something else. Or so there will be evolving levels to this mirror match in these quite obscure cases as we get into this first round of regional championships. But the level zero thing that's causing all of that is, yeah, I'm gonna get the Stonebrain and take your Khans, and now you are dead to rights effectively.
What I am hearing is that Nicol Bolas stands another chance in Modern, and that or in Pioneer, and that is going to be awesome. Like, I think that is a play that everyone wants to see. Every time someone taps five forests and casts Nicol Bolas Dragon God is a good day for Magic, and the Stonebrain is making that happen.
Absolutely. I guess we'll give this a brief interlude to note the Might Stone and the Weak Stone. So this is the five mana card that is meant to be melding with Urza, but in this context it's just making your Khan even more flexible. So it's five mana, it taps for two, but it has the Power Stone clause, so it can only be spent, or it can't be spent to cast non-artifact spells. And when it ETBs, you can either draw two cards or give something -5/-5 until end of turn. So this is effectively a very big removal spell that on the following turn can give you 2 mana to activate your Nykthos or something, for example. That one seems pretty marginal to me, but I could believe that it's in like the top 15 artifacts for your wishboard. In any case, going back to the Stonebrain for a second, I think this is a good way to transition into modern here. I think that card is quite alluring in the context of the modern Karn sideboard, because there are just more combo decks that get shut off single-handedly by that card. So you think of Creativity, all the various Cascade decks, opposing Tron decks, given that I think Tron is where you expect to see this in your own Karn sideboard. Amulet Titan, just all of these cards or decks named after a single card or a single strategy where Stonebrain is potentially very useful. But then you run into this issue again of, for example, against the Cascade decks, if you're on the draw, unless you have exactly Gemstone Caverns, there's basically no way that your Stonebrain can be fast enough to get activated before they get to Cascade. So if you lose game one, maybe you steal game two on the back of Stonebrain, but then game three, you're on the draw, your opening hand has a Stonebrain in it. Are you feeling that confident against like Living End or Glimpse, for example? And that's the issue, that's the other side of that coin in Modern, I think, where the Stonebrain has many more decks that it's good against, but how many of those can you actually deploy in a relevant time frame? That one is less clear to me. And so against Tron, for example, this was always the issue with cards like Unmoored Ego or Necromancer, where their best draws, if they were on the play, they had Tron and they had a payoff on the board already by the time that you got to cast this card. And I think the reason you see, for example, Necromancer doing so well in Modern these days is because the Necromancer decks can often cast it turn two off Ragavan or Ignoble Hierarch or something. You actually get to ramp into that even on the draw, and you almost by definition can't do that with the Stonebrain.
Yeah, I also want to point out another math issue here, which is when you play Karn the Great Creator on turn three off a Tron and then wish for the Stonebrain, you are stuck with 3 mana and a 4 mana cost to pay. So you can't even line that up the way you want it to.
Yes. And I think in general, effects like this, you know, my article this week goes over the history of Jester's Caps and Lobotomies and so on. And the one thing they all have in common is people love these cards and board them in even when they shouldn't. But outside of exactly Jester's Cap, there was always this color pie, like EDH style limit to where you could actually do that. So this is why Surgical Extraction was such a dangerous printing, was because everyone could feel the temptation of Surgical Extraction and trick themselves into over sideboarding it in. For the most part, you know, your Necromancers are only being incorrectly sideboarded in your black deck. Anyone can board the Stonebrain end when they shouldn't, and I think a whole new generation of players is going to bamboozle themselves into bringing this card in matchups or situations where they absolutely should not do that.
I mean, the card is literally a big brain, and you're allowed to make a big brain maneuver with it of boarding it when you shouldn't. Yeah, let's move into cards that might have an impact on both formats. Let's just start with an easy hyper hate on Diabolic Intent, a card that Doomwake has been massively hyping up.
Yes, this card is not getting banned, whether it's in Pioneer or Modern or anywhere else, and I'm not quite sure it's even playable, necessarily. I think this is it's almost the perfect reprint, insofar as it looks very dangerous, and it's appealing to try and build decks around this card, but I expect its actual representation in top 8s in a month or two to be pretty slim, if that.
Yeah, I just want to compare it to Eldritch Evolution, a card legal in both formats, so when you sack a creature to Eldritch Evolution, you get the creature you want, you have paid one more mana, and you are guaranteed to make more than that mana back by, you know, just putting the thing into play. Like, think about how much it costs to Diabolic Intent for something. It's 2 mana, the cost of the card, and the cost of whatever you sacked. And, like, that is spread out over a lot of turns in theory, but that's just so much mana.
It is, and you see this issue with, I think, Modern Yawgmoth, for example. Seems like the obvious home for that card, if one does exist. This is the deck which has so much sacrifice fodder already and had the specific cards that it has an interest in finding. It has these toolboxes which maybe you could translate over to Diabolic Intent instead. But the issue being, if you're trying to curve out with your Yawgmoth deck, well, you want to find your namesake card. That card costs 4 mana, and it is much easier just mathematically to get up to, you know, Convoke Call of Calling for 4 to find Yawgmoth, or Eldritch Evolution sacking my 2-drop to find Yawgmoth, than it is to pay 2 to find it, and then have to just pay the 4 mana sticker price as well. I think that you know, you kind of want this narrow overlap of, I have enough cheap creatures to enable this as an early play. I also then have a specific card that is so powerful that I really want to jump through these hoops to find it. But then I need that card to also be cheap enough that eventually I can, let's say I top deck Diabolic Intent in the mid game, that I can intend to find that card and cast it in the same turn. And I think that overlap just effectively doesn't really exist in most of these formats.
Yeah, and I guess we can jump off of that into a card that we kind of excluded from our Karn discussion, which is Haywire Mite. This is the one mana artifact creature with green, exile it to exile a non-creature artifact or enchantment, and then, what is it, when it dies, you gain a life?
You gain two life, in fact. Yeah,
oh, so, that's a lot of life.
Oh, was this the card that you were intentionally holding back because this was the guaranteed player?
No, I think Cityscape Leveler is the bigger deal. I think the big issue with Mite in both cases is, well, let's start. In Pioneer, my issue is the creature part. You can, like, Karn for it to kill their Sky Sovereign, but, like, there's this whole discussion of, like, why are you Karning to kill their Sky Sovereign? You have Karn, like, just don't have your Karn die, and then their Sky Sovereign doesn't matter. But, like, I don't really know, like, what things you're killing with this aside from fires and Enigmatic Incarnation that really matter.
Yeah, Leyline Binding, I think, would be an increasingly popular one. It's yet another nail in the coffin of something like Jeskai Ascendancy or what have you. I think that this definitely becomes part of the Karn toolbox for Mono Green, if no other reason, honestly, than just Karning for this as a one-mana blocker that gains two life on its way out is a very solid defensive play in a lot of cases, and that's going to be this kind of hidden secret mode of Mite, especially if you're playing the mono greenness to have Lovestruck Beast, which I don't know if you can do as much if the mirror is going to become even more popular, because that card is like the worst of the possible flex slots in the mirror. But if you are, this is a 1-1 that you can Karn for that helps to turn that on. But I think in Modern and beyond, this card is a complete game changer in the sense of, I mean, it's great in your Karn rich board. So you might see Amulet Titan with a renewed interest in Karn in those flex slots, in part because your Haywire Mite is a very cheap searchable answer to Blood Moon, for example, where like Silver Oak Replica and stuff like that can do it, but really not at a good cost. This is a cheap and efficient way to do it. But the real application here is with Urza Saga, I think, where if you just look at these Urza Saga fights you can get into, if you have the first Saga, well, now you have this very appealing line of, you know, I make a construct end of turn, I untap, I make another construct, I fetch my Haywire Mite, I immediately play a green source and blow up your Urza Saga, and now you have to feel very far ahead. And just in general, like the ability to turn your Urza Saga into a potential naturalize, that makes it even more flexible across the board, including against Blood Moon. This is, I think, an error that people are identifying where, well, Blood Moon just kills your Saga, so this can't be an answer to it. In practice, like, firstly, they're not always going to have turn 3 Blood Moon rolled up. It's sometimes going to be this kind of mid-game play or something, and being able to preemptively fetch Mite is a nice hedge against that. But also, if you're on the play, I can imagine with Amulet, for example, if you think your opponent kept a weak hand on the strength of Blood Moon, you can play your turn 1 Urza Saga and just pop it off and have it fetch Haywire Mite on turn 3 and have that layer of insurance ready to go. So I think that those fairly obvious applications are enough to get this card a fair hearing. And then there's stuff which it can do that other similar effects just can't do. So, for example, this exiles the non-creature artifact or enchantment, so you can hit their Cauldron Complete with this. You can hit their Darksteel Citadel. You can, you know, you can find these applications everywhere you look, and I think there are easily enough of those that this becomes an automatic consideration. The one thing holding it back in Modern, I think, is I don't know how many green Saga decks there are, so outside of like Amulet Titan and maybe Hardened Scales or something, but maybe this is a reason to, for example, revisit green as a splash in your Hammer deck, or to go back to something like Jund Saga. I imagine this is going to be very strong there. Maybe in Team of Breach, where this hits Underworld Breach, this hits their Urza Sagas, but it's also a very nice card to be able to fetch with your own. I think this card is just a very compelling reason by itself to be a Saga deck with green in it.
Yeah, you have talked me through a lot of these slam dunk cases. I am now way more interested in this card in Modern than I was. I was just thinking about it in the Pioneer case where it's like, this is the best thing at doing what it does, but I don't even know if I need what it does. So it might end up being the, like, 16th card in my Karn board. In Modern, that makes a lot of sense. Is like, this is a great card to find with Urza Saga that was not previously accessible.
Yeah, and Modern, a format where Leyline Binding is increasingly popular. You hit their Underworld Breach, you hit their Amulet of Vigor, their Colossus Hammer, or Sigarda's Aid. Just the non-creature clause here actually feels like you have to look to find things which that cares about as opposed to things where it doesn't. Like, most of the premium artifacts or enchantments are non-creatures, and that's part of what makes them such big players in the format to begin with, is they don't easily die to like an Unholy Heat or a Solitude or something.
Yeah, that is this is just another condensation of card types being accessible to Answer and Modern in a lot of different ways, and making, you know, like the Blood Moons and Ensnaring Bridges of the format a lot less scary than they have ever been.
Yeah, I think one other use for this card is in Yawgmoth, where you have Adeline Liberator, and that card is strong, but if you want something cheaper than that to Call of Calling for, well, this is as cheap as it really gets in that regard. And, you know, the life gain can be pretty nice when you're working towards the Yawgmoth. If you're drawing a bunch of cards and just having this extra one drop that you can draw and play is pretty nice there too. But I think the big deal is just, you know, I'm on low resources. I can Call of Calling 4/1 and pop this a decent amount of the time, and that frees me up to do whatever that artifact or enchantment was preventing me from doing.
Yeah, I don't know. I really like the backside of Outland Liberator against Urza Saga, and it's going to be a tough sell for me to not have access to that.
Mm-hmm. One other Yawgmoth candidate, actually, to move on here is Skyfisher Spider. So this is 2GB for a 3/3 reach. When it ETBs, you may sacrifice another creature, and when you do, destroy target non-land permanent. And then when it dies, you can gain one life for each creature card in your graveyard, and if you do, you then exile the spider from your graveyard. So Shades of Grist, in the sense of this is another thing that you can like search for, sacrifice some insect token or young wolf or whatever to destroy, not just Motai Regent, which is where that kind of overlap happens, but this is a lot more flexible. So you can destroy the Leyline Binding that's currently suppressing your Yawgmoth, or moving that Grist play pattern to all non-land permanents really opens up a lot of flexibility to that effect and makes your chords and your Eldritch Evolutions that much more powerful.
Yeah, it's good. I guess the all-type flexibility, I am skeptical that this card is actually better than Grist in a lot of situations. But the, like, being able to trade a Grist access for access to something that handles enchantments and artifacts in the main deck is reasonable to look at. I don't know. Also, more 4-drops just scares me a lot.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of naturalizers, let's talk about Loran of the Third Path. So this is 2W for a 2/1 Vigilance. Legendary Human Artificer. When it ETBs, you destroy up to one target artifact or enchantment, and then it has tap, you and target opponent each draw a card. So at a baseline, this is the white reclamation sage that various creature toolbox decks have wanted for a while. Very nice in these white, like, Yorion, Flickerwisp style decks. But also, that weird tap ability, I think it's going to come up a decent amount in these stalled games, where if Loran sticks around for a while, your end of turn, you activate it, you untap, you activate it again, you now have a first call on those additional resources that both players have opened up. And if you are one of these decks that is trying to constrict their ability to use their resources with stuff like Thalia, or these, like, you can only play one spell a turn effects or stuff like that, then you kind of are breaking that symmetry already without trying too hard.
Yeah, I'm not too interested in pairing this with Spirit of the Labyrinth. I'm with you that just, like, having the first crack at using your spell is pretty important, and you can just build your deck in a way that makes it easier to use your mana. Do not try to do this with Leon and Arbiter, I'm just telling you right now. But, yeah, everything else about this card, just like, I don't know, if you just want to pay white mana for a Rex Sage instead of green mana, that's great, and that's on the table.
Yeah, if you enjoy playing Aether Vial and Caracas in Legacy, I expect this is a great pickup for you, but I am not one such person, so I will be moving swiftly on to Third Path Iconoclast, a card which I expect to make its presence known in Pioneer and potentially Modern, and then potentially in Legacy as well, even.
I think that this is just the best card in the set, right? Like, this could potentially see Vintage play, too. Just every single format has something to do with this card. I mean, in Modern, I guess we should bring up the, like, elephant in the room with, like, this card and Breach, where this was discussed on Twitter by Mengu today, where if you control a Third Path Iconoclast and you have more cards in library than your opponent, and then also, there might be, like, some margin there, you have Grinding Station, Breach, and Mishra's Bauble with no extra mana, you just win the game. I don't think that is, like, as direct a game changer as it feels like for the combo side of things, because it's kind of hard to, like, go off from, like, you still need to play the Oracle or the Grapeshot, because there's just going to be games where you don't have anything, and if you're milling yourself to dig for, like, gotta find my Mox Amber and my Third Path Iconoclast, like, you're just not going to have cards in your graveyard to do it, even if you're, like, doubling up on Iconoclast. What it really means is that just, like, random board states are going to be more threatening. You're going to be able to combo off of lower resources and all just using a card that is good in your deck normally without anything else going on. It's just like, oh, my deck has Third Path, Iconoclast, and some spells. That is a good threat. Yeah, way better than Ledger Shredder.
As a quick reminder, this is the blue-red 2-1 Human Monk. When you cast a non-creature spell, you create a 1-1 colorless Soldier Artifact Creature Token. So a souped-up Young Pyromancer of Swords, and when you try building decks with cards like this, even in a deck like Is It Phoenix, where you are primarily a instant and sorcery-focused deck, you still find lots of scenarios where this is a relevant upgrade, whether it's, you know, you're boarding into some kind of Planeswalker card for the grinding matchups, right? And this also triggers off of that. Or you have some relevant enchantment, or maybe you can play this with Fable in a deck where, like, well, now this triggers Fable, and then eventually if you can copy this with Fable and just start casting spells, and you really get to go off. So even in those timelines, there's a lot of upside to this card. And then there are entire strategies where Pyromancer basically has no text, and this really just is phenomenal. So yeah, you mentioned in Modern Breach, like, the fact that this triggers off artifacts means every Mishra's Bauble, every Mox Amber, every, you know, fill in the blank here, every Underworld Breach gets you this additional resource to play with. And the actual sequencing of these infinite lines, I think, is a little too onerous to really come up. Like, I'm not sure where this is leading you to an infinite kill in a spot where the traditional setup wouldn't. But just as a fair card, a good backup plan that fills that flex slot potentially currently debated between Ledger Shredder and Fable and other stuff, I could see this doing a lot of good work there.
Yeah, I think that the additional kill is a little more useful than you're saying here. Where, like, if you just imagine playing this card and then just, like, turn four going Breach and Grinding Station and having no extra mana, you couldn't kill otherwise, and now you can. That's really it. Like I said, it's not, like, drastically changing the combo. It's just, like, if this card is on the battlefield, it gets really scary in a lot of ways.
I think it also opens up these smaller value breaches where you're not actually going infinite, but you're just casting this Unholy Heat over here and maybe recycling the same Mishra's Bauble a time or two. If in the process of doing that, you're getting just an additional four or five bodies on the battlefield, like, that goes a long way too.
Yeah, this is the Underworld Breach as Treasure Cruise line with Mishra's Bauble. Yeah, that is really powerful with this card. Do you see reasons to play this card over Young Pyromancer in Pioneer? I almost don't, because I have concerns about the mana cost, but are there enchantments or artifacts you would like to put into your many spells casting deck that would make this the card you'd want instead of Pyro? Or are there ways to make use of the fact that it makes artifacts?
Yeah, I think if you want to be like a Fable plus Crackling Drake deck, then maybe this has upside there. The issue in Classic Phoenix is in the mirror or the pseudo mirror, this is additionally weak to both Rending Volley and Mystical Dispute, which is a pretty big deal, versus Pyromancer dodging both of those cards. So unless you have a compelling reason to make that switch, I think sticking with Young Pyromancer instead makes a lot of sense. And then as you get into the larger formats where you have free artifacts like Mishra's Bauble or Mox Amber and so on, I wonder if this opens up a type of deck that just didn't have the kind of payoff that it needed before, where I'm not sure what this would be exactly, but, you know, Ledger Shredder plus Mishra's Bauble is a powerful combination. This plus Mishra's Bauble did so. And so maybe there's some fair-ish deck or, like, new-looking deck with those cards, which didn't have enough reasons to exist before, and maybe this is the tipping point.
You said fairish, and I thought you were going to talk me towards like paradoxical outcome, but isn't Breach the fairish deck?
I guess it might be. Yeah, I mean, maybe that is just the answer there. But I could see something in the vein of like when Grixis Shadow used to be sideboarding into Pyromancers, where this is that, but it also triggers off your Baubles and so on.
Yeah, I mean, it's clearly better in all of those cases. I just am somewhat skeptical that Pyromancer is the is a good solo threat in Modern these days.
There is also, you mentioned, can you leverage the fact that these are artifacts? So it makes your Urza Sagas a lot better. I think that's pretty clear. But what if you can play this like with actual Urza or with something which lets you immediately leverage those artifacts in the same way that you think back to the Urza outcome decks? And here I am talking you into paradoxical outcome. They were briefly popular in 2019 where, you know, Saheeli Sublime Artificer with Urza let you just kind of like cycle through everything for as long as you had cards, and once you get to double down on that half of that effect, then maybe there's something you can do there.
Is there, like, it feels like there's an artifact that lets you loop itself in some silly way where once you are generating an extra artifact to make an extra mana each loop, that's like the actual thing that's going on. I'm not entirely sure there what it would be. I'm thinking like a White Mane Lion style effect, where you're using the token and the creature, tapping Urza in the middle to get everything to work.
Yeah, I'm not sure what fills that role exactly, but either way, this card has some very obvious applications and is flexible and exciting enough that you can look for other spots where it can do some good work for you as well.
Yeah, it just, again, very obviously the slam dunk card in the set. Not a lot to talk about beyond that. I think that there is one other card that might see play in both formats that I want to talk about, and that's Brotherhood's End. This is the latest in the long line of Sweltering Suns, Anger of the God variants. So it is one red, deal 3 to each creature and each planeswalker. This is like the first one of these that has dealt damage to planeswalkers, correct?
I think so. In the same way that, you know, we saw Lava Coil being upgraded into the new ref on that, and a lot of the creature-only damage spells these days also deal damage to planeswalkers now, so I think this is just another step in that direction.
Yeah, and then there's the aura of destroy all artifacts with mana value 3 or less. Honestly, I'm just more into this for the ability that sweeps up all the planeswalkers on top of killing all the creatures. It's very easy to imagine scenarios where you want the full sweep in that capacity.
Yeah, I think this card is actually surprisingly bad at killing artifacts, where in Modern these days, you're either against some kind of affinity deck where they're building towards, you know, Sojourner's Companion, Thought Monitor and stuff, and this just misses a vast swathe of those cards, or you're against Hammer, where, yeah, you get their Ornithopter and their Springleaf Drum, and maybe their Hammer if they have to expose it early, but you left their Cigala's Aid and their Urza Saga in place, so you're probably dead next turn regardless.
Yeah, I don't like it as an artifact sweeper, but the fact that it, in theory, could do that is great.
Yeah, against Hammer, you might actually play it more often for the 3 damage mode sometimes, just if they need to, you know, they play their Stoneforge Mystic, they fetch Cauldron Complete, or they have to play out their Pure Seal Paladin to set up earlier, or you got to sweep their Giver of Runes now because you're not going to get another chance. Like, I could actually see that being the more relevant mode in the matchup there.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree with that. Their creatures are generally more threatening than their artifact spread, except for the Hammer on the turn they kill you, and you need an instant for that.
Yeah,
just a novel and good effect.
Two very quick hits to finish this off. There's Overwhelming Remorse. This is a 4 and a black for an instant, but it costs 1 less to cast for each creature in your graveyard, and you get to exile target creature or planeswalker. I thought maybe there's some strange build of Living End that could use this, where it dodges the Cascade Restriction, but it also has the same Leyline Binding pattern of, you know, 1 mana kill your Teferi and then immediately get to Cascade again.
Yeah, that's a good point that Murderous Cut didn't offer you that in the context of killing a Teferi. That's pretty interesting. I hadn't thought about that exact application.
It does also, in that scenario, exile their creature if you're hitting a creature with that instead. And unlike Murderous Cut, it doesn't delve away the things you're trying to get back with the Living End that this is meant to free up in the first place. So you would have to be a pretty black heavy build of Living End, but we have seen some of those pop up from time to time, so maybe something to keep in mind there. And then the last one, which I know has got some people's brains turning already, is Arcane Proxy. So this is the blue mythic prototype card. It's 7 for a 4-3, or crucially, 1 blue for a 2-1, and when it ETBs, if you cast it, you exile target instant or sorcery with mana value less than or equal to its power from your graveyard. You copy that card, you exile the, and then you cast a copy without paying its mana cost. So if you cast it 4-3, you're looking at anything that costs 2 or less. So you can find some fair uses for the card, and if you're really trying to make See the Truth happen, this is yet another way to do that. But I think people have eyed this up in the context of Cascade, where your Crashing Footfalls cost 0. Your Living End, it costs 0. And so I don't know quite what the deck looks like that can accommodate this as well, but if you want just like another rebuy on that effect, then maybe this is something you can look at.
Yeah, I think it's likely to involve like very specific lists of like rhinos or something where you're more interested in a fair game. I guess this is technically a better Goblin Dark Dwellers if you're going down that road with Glimpse.
Well, no, because you have to cast the Arcane Proxy is the problem.
Oh, gross. Never mind, disregard that. I also want to point out, the 7-mana version of this is so much worse than the 3-mana version. Like,
yes.
It is a comical disparity. Like, when you're casting, like, Combat Thresher or Phyrexian Flesh Gorger, like, either of the other really good ones, like, the 7-mana version is awesome. The 7-mana version in this one is just, like, I don't know, I'd rather have the 3-mana version one in 4-mana a lot of the time, as opposed to just the 4-3 when I don't really want to build my deck around flashbacking 3 and 4 cost spells because it's so unlikely.
Yeah, I think that in the conventional Cascade decks, this doesn't really have a home. I think it's more likely to show up in, I don't know, if you were building some weird like Azrathol deck that has a bunch of Ancestral Vision and maybe like Crashing Footfalls or Living End or something, I could see it in there.
Are we going to cast Restore? No.
Probably not if they get to keep their Murtide region or something now. Maybe that Resurgent Belief deck that I really wanted to work can fit this in somewhere, but I'm not too optimistic on that front.
Yeah, that's about where it's at with that one.
Actually, now that I think about it, humor me for a second. Like, in that deck, there's this kind of fork in the road you have to take, where either you try to be a Cascade deck with all the restrictions that imposes upon you, or you can try to be a deck which is using cards like Faithful Mending and so on to dump your big enchantments in the graveyard, and then using stuff like Azrathol to cast the Resurgent Belief that then gets those back. So it's a lot easier to set up, but then harder to actually do your thing, and this makes it slightly easier to do the thing.
Well, then what, like, I don't really want to play this card as just like, this is how I cast my thing from the graveyard, because that just doesn't seem like the most efficient and best use of my time. So what are the other spells? Like, you're just using this to flashback Faithful Mending without paying the cost? Like, I that's the other part of this, is like, when, gosh, that doesn't even work, because can you fire ice with...
I don't think you can anymore.
Yeah, this is the other issue with this card in Cascade decks, is I don't want to just hit the thing I'm cascading into. I think that this is one of those cards where, like, you're trying to answer too many questions about how you're using it to make it worth using.
Yes. So with that, I think that mostly exhausts the cards that we have our eye on for now. Let's jump ahead to our nonsense of the week here. And a friend of the show, Aspiring Spike, who maybe will join us one day, who knows, has blessed us with yet another off-the-wall brew, which seems to have some potential at the very least.
Yeah, so this is a interesting Fate Stitcher combo deck. Fate Stitcher is the 3 and a blue 1/2 zombie wizard from Charge of Alara with tap. You may untap or tap another target permanent and unearth of a blue. The key here being the unearth of a blue and the untap ability. So the goal here is to cast Mesmeric Orb. This is the 2-mana artifact that whenever a permanent untaps, that permanent's controller mills a card. And you are comboing that with Fate Stitcher. So if you unearth 2 Fate Stitchers at once, you can dredge your entire deck, just untapping them back and forth forever. That will find you a Memory's Journey to shuffle back in a Thassa's Oracle, or if you have a billion mana, you can actually just flashback in on Burial Rites. And that's the kill here.
Yeah, and so I don't know if this qualifies as a one-card combo. Maybe that's stretching the definition very loosely. But in theory, if you just cast a Turn 2 Mesmeric Orb, that over time, in conjunction with all of these other self-mill effects and so on, will lead you to a position where you can find the first Fate Stitcher, which will then in turn help you find the second Fate Stitcher. And from there, you can piece together the kill. There is actually a Brothers War card, which I think could be very good in this archetype. And that is Recommission, where you can just buy back your Mesmeric Orb, which, this is your crucial combo piece, and sometimes you're going to mill that one over, or they're just going to Thought Seize it, or destroy it, or what have you, and this gets that back. But also, once you're working your way towards the combo, if you're on low resources, this can buy you back a Thassa's Oracle to get the job done there. So I don't know what exactly you would cut for it, but that seems like a pretty nice upgrade to the deck.
Yeah, that's a very fair point. I don't love that it only can return two cards in the entire deck, but I think there might be ways to build around that.
Mm-hmm. And then we have, I'm going to call an audible here to talk about the Ryan Peterson deck that actually went 5-2 in one of the weekend challenges. This is Dredge Creativity. So this is your grandfather's Dredge deck, but we have 4 Persist and 4 Arcanum Cruelty in the main deck here. So Persist is kind of an interesting card in this context, where you can technically persist a Secret Imp that then becomes an 0-1, so it's not trading with anything anymore, but yeah, so what? Or you can persist an Oxvigonus, but like, what is the situation where you actually have fewer than 8 cards in your graveyard in the first place? Like, that's not clear to me. But the main appeal here is you can just persist Arcanum Cruelty, and between 4 Otherworldly Gaze and 4 Dark Lust as 1-drops, and then you have this usual pack of Thrilling Discovery and Cathartic Reunion, you can, if you have persist in hand at the very least, very consistently get that Archon in the graveyard and be able to return it by turn 3. And that gives you the extra oomph that you might need to get across the finish line here. Because one issue that we highlighted with Dredge in the past is that you can make a board that's like 2 Price Amalgams and an Archimedes or something, and maybe you ding them for 3 with a Creeping Chill. Okay, but that's not very impressive by modern standards. You really need to kind of tear through your whole deck to get enough of those effects that they add up to something meaningful. If you have an Archon by itself, that is something meaningful, and it actually combines somewhat nicely with your Creeping Chills. And Archon of Cruelty triggering Silver Smoke Goal is not something that I'd seen before, but now I really want to see that actually happen.
Yeah, and this actually feels like the exact deck for another Brothers War card that we had discussed, right? You had said, and I think you brought this up, where it's like, well, Archon of Creativity really wants haste from your Bitter Reunion, and also, like, it is a natural card to filter through to find your nonsense sideboard cards. Yeah, or just all of the above.
Yeah, I mean, I could actually see a more conventional creativity persist deck where the Bitter Reunion is setting up those persist lines more efficiently, but can then also enable your Fable properly on the crucial turn. Like, maybe there is something there, I don't know. But in any case, that's only the main deck. Once we move over to the sideboard, we get the full genius on display here, where we've got our 2 spell pieces, which I guess you can use in lots of different ways. But then we have 4 Dwarven Mine, 4 Fable of the Mirror Breaker, 4 Indomitable Creativity, and a Transmogrify. And so this is, we haven't seen a true transformational sideboard in quite some time. This clears that bar easily and mightily, I would argue.
Yeah, the image I saw of the deck list had the 15 cards that come out for the 15 cards or 13 cards that come in. Very conveniently, if you count the creatures, there's 11 things you have to sideboard out there, so you've got some wiggle room in the spell slots once you're sideboarding.
Yeah, so you can board out your 4 Creeping Chills, your 2 Oxes, your Golgari Thug, your 4 Sequined Imp, and your 4 Silver Smoke Goals, move away from the entire Dredge angle of the deck, effectively, and just become this, like, hybrid creativity reanimator combo deck.
I mean, that was a deck that people were just playing, the Grixis Creativity deck.
Yeah, and those persists in that version were not very good and not very consistent. In this deck, your persists are really, really good.
Yeah, and I guess another thing to bring up with Bitter Reunion, these Thrilling Discoveries in the mana base look pretty sketchy. And I mean, Thrilling Discovery is by far the better card to dredge with, but like, I don't know. It's the only card that requires white mana in the entire deck.
Yeah, we have somehow worked our way towards a creativity deck with a more shaky mana base than the stock versions have.
Very impressive.
Yes. I do love the 4 Dwarven Mines in the sideboard, as a note of the fact that, like, yeah, in theory, we could work some of these into our actual mana base, but we really cannot risk doing that. Like, the mana is so bad as it is. And actually, to circle back around to Diabolic Intent for a second, there are a lot of lands, and especially fetchable lands in Modern, that give you that thing that you can use as fodder for intent. So Dwarven Mine comes to mind. Colony Garden you can't fetch, but you can just play a deck with a bunch of Colony Gardens in it. Or Dryad Arbor would be a good example too. So it actually doesn't feel all that difficult to satisfy that half of the equation. It's just the constraints involved in casting intent and something relevant on the same turn that I think holds it back. But maybe Persist is that card, right? Like, if you build a reanimated deck with like four Citrus Supplier and some other stuff, and then you can set up for a turn four where you intent for your Persist and cast it, or your Glorious Vengeance or whatever it is, maybe that actually gets a job done.
I think it would have to be Goryeo's Vengeance, because it would have to be a card that is unique enough. Like, there are just four mana persists that you could play. Like, Zombify exists. There doesn't really exist a four mana equivalent to Goryeo's Vengeance. I think it just literally has to be that card. Or Footsteps of the Goryeo. I'm not going to tell anyone to play Protean Hulk in 2022, but that is the start of how you do it.
Protean Hulk, one of those cards effectively soft banned by Solitude, I think. But speaking of Solitude, I think it does hurt Diabolic Intent that it doesn't work the way you really want it to with your Griefs and your Solitude and so on, where you can't evoke and then Diabolic Intent the creature away while it's in the play, because, you know, Diabolic Intent is a sorcery, and so there's just no window to do that, as compared to something like a Village Rites or a Deadly Dispute or Ephemerate, stuff like that.
Yeah, I am not a Diabolic Intent believer, and all these things are adding up to even more reasons to not be a believer.
Let's close this out then with a Spirit Sisters Call combo control deck, I suppose.
I want to talk about the other. Okay, let's quickly go over this, because this is a nice little pioneer brew. Spirit Sisters Call is a 3-white-black enchantment from Neon Dynasty that at the beginning of your end step you can basically sack a permanent to reanimate a card that shares a type with that permanent. And then there's some like clause about exiling that other permanent if it would die. Really, this deck is just an Esper deck that is using that as a path to reanimate Omniscience. And I guess from there, you are maybe technically going infinite with Hullbreaker Horror. There's like some stuff you can do, but like, I don't know. Once you have an Omniscience, you kind of win the game, is my understanding of what's going on here.
Yeah, I think it seems quite convoluted to actually do that. I'm not sure if it's better than just getting back like a Kiora, Best of Sea God, or some like Overwhelming Splendor, I think would be a good example. Just some big idiot that happens to be an enchantment, although maybe those are in short supply, I don't know.
Well, that is fair. I think Kiora, Best of Sea God is a good example of this. Yeah, it looks like the infinite involves, like, if you have two copies of Spirited Companion or the Modern Age or Omen of the Sea, I guess, just like any permanent that cantrips once you have the Hullbreaker Horror and Omniscience. And I guess part of this is also that you can sacrifice your Spirited Companion or your Wandering Emperor to get back Hullbreaker Horror, at which point the game also may as well be over, you know, completely over.
Yeah, Spirited Companion doing a nice little bridging the gap there. And beyond that, we're just a combo control deck. We've got Supreme Verdict, we've got some removal, we have some removal attached to our enchantments like Trial of Ambition, Oath of Kaya. This is a almost like a weirdly kind of inverted, color shifted incarnation deck of sorts.
Yeah, it is along the same lines, but also it doesn't do weird things, it just does the same weird thing, which is in its own way weird because of looking at the incarnation deck list and just being like, yeah, those are all cards that, in theory, you could want at some point, and I hope that point occurs for you.
Yeah, I think this is a deck which you could build in such a way that it's maybe more competitive, but I love the basic core of what's going on here.
Yeah, Spirit Sisters Call, really powerful card. Let us actually close out with... We mentioned Respect the Cat finishing top 16 in a challenge with the respectable version of Karuga. The leagues have been brought the disrespectful version of Karuga, which is just Karuga 70. This is a 70-card Karuga deck that just adds more cards. There is a Soul of Windgrace and 4 Scion of Dracos and just more lands, it looks like.
Yeah, I know there were some reports immediately after the Yorion ban of people showing up to their LGS at the weekend with, like, just 80 cards no Yorion because I didn't have the time or the inclination to actually rejig my deck or change archetype. I just, this is my modern deck. I can't play Yorion anymore. Here's a 15th card instead, and let's get to work. This almost feels like the opposite, where I almost innovated this entirely overlooked companion by myself, and now I'm going out of my way to add more cards to make a very specific statement.
Yeah, well, I think the better statement may be the one, Respect the Cat was asked on Twitter, how was Soul of Windgrace for you? And the response was, I haven't had a moment where it felt good whenever I played it, but it's a cat, I have to try.
But really, there's no topping that, and I don't think we will attempt to do that ourselves. So I think we will usher you all out of here for now. As always, you can find us on Twitter at Dom and Javier at ARMLX. You can find the podcast on Twitter at Dominaria_pod. You can find the podcast on Patreon, once again, at patreon.com/Dominarias_judgment. And you can find us and many more people and a wide swathe of nonsense in its own right in the Discord. So link to all of that in the show notes. We will be back with, I assume, a Pioneer episode, looking ahead to the regional championships next week. But until then, take care, everyone.